Eastern Brady. I am Marjorie Egan. You are listening to Boston Public Radio 89.7 WGBH.
Hi there, Marjorie.
Hey, Jim.
You know, we left the studio 22 hours ago. So much has happened relative to the Marathon bombing and the September 11th, 2011 triple murder in Waltham. Let's start with the bombing, if we can, for a second. You know, once the smoke had cleared, questions began arising as to whether or not the Marathon bombing could have been prevented. Every law enforcement person we and others talked to and elected officials, everyone, including the governor with us, said no. In the middle of that, Congressman Bill Keating from Massachusetts joined us maybe a week after the Marathon bombings. He had this to say about preventing similar bombing in the future.
We're going to try and minimize those risks, and we're going to try and improve the response at every level. And that means digging into the issues of how people become radicalized, what's going on, are there earlier signals to deal with that? So it's dealing with preventative issues as well as trying to uncover what's going on.
So when Keating was with us, he was talking about the future.
Right.
Well, Keating is now in Moscow, and he's talking about the past. Bill Keating went to Moscow with a congressional delegation. I'm sure you've heard about it this morning. He met with, amongst others, the Russian Federal Security Service. And listen to what Keating had to say after those meetings. Quote, "You can see with the level of these details that, in fact, if we had had better information sharing, meaning back here, there's a very strong chance that things could have changed and the bombings could have been avoided." How chilling is that? By the way, it's no surprise. We've been talking about this here, and I'm sure others have as well, for weeks and weeks about the stovepiping, you know, the protection of information, one agency from another, the whole back and forth between the FBI and the Boston cops. Is that not chilling? What do you think if you hear Bill Keating and you're the family of one of the three people killed on Boylston Street or one of the 260 was injured? What's your reaction?
Well, it undermines your confidence in our anti-terrorism bureaucracy. The story in the Globe this morning has the Russians warning Americans at least three times about Tamil and Tsarnaev. And repeatedly, the response they got from the United States, the CIA, the anti-terrorism bureaucracy was nothing. Zero. Zip. So that's one of our questions to you guys at 877-301-8970 and BPR at WGBH.org. That's our email address, 877-301-8970, BPR at WGBH.org. Is considering what Congressman Keating just said in Moscow, what should be done here? And also, have we been too busy celebrating the bravery? And indeed, there was great bravery of the first responders, but not busy enough demanding answers for possibly dropping the ball here on the Tsarnaevs.
You know, also, remember Ed Davis's testimony, and he stepped back from this. Ed Davis is in front of Congress. This is one of the first signs to me that there were some serious issues about information sharing. Here's Ed Davis on May 9th testifying before Congress.
But if there's a Russian intelligence warning that this man was an extremist that may travel overseas, and the fact that he did travel overseas and came back into the United States, would that may not have caused you to give this individual a second look?
Absolutely.
And that individual, obviously, is Tamerlan Tsarnaev. So at 877-301-8970, what's your reaction to Bill Keating saying this? By the way, there's been speculation by people like me and Marjorie and some in the media about the possibility of having prevented the bombings of April 15th, Marathon Monday. But this is the first time, to my knowledge, that a high-ranking public official, after meeting with key authorities, in this case the Russian authorities, has said this thing could have been prevented. This can't be just a short shelf life kind of story. After 9/11, what was the basic message other than the glory of the courage of the first responders? What was it?
We have to start sharing information among these various anti-terrorism groups. And we talked about this a couple of weeks ago, and it was the Frontline special. We talked to the reporter from the Washington Post.
Dana Priest.
And her major point is that we have spent billions of dollars beefing up our anti-terrorism efforts. But they're piecemeal, and there's no...
No, that we're brilliant at collecting information. We don't spend nearly enough time analyzing and sharing it.
Yes, but also that they were piecemeal, and there was no one person where the buck stops. Mm. There's no, president of the anti-terrorism networks, so someone we could point to right now and say, well, why didn't you know this? And that was hugely upsetting, and you get this sense that we're spending all this money very ineffectively.
And by the way, none of this undercuts, so don't get angry, none of this undercuts the bravery of the individuals who did the work they did on the Thursday and Friday here after it was clear that the Tsarnaevs were the people they were looking at. It really has nothing to do with that. It has to do with agencies who are charged with the mission of sharing information they get to protect the American people, at least according to Bill Keating. And I would say it's a pretty decent source, not protect him. Can we add one thing to this discussion, though? The story of this Ibrahim Tadashev, who was killed, it was being interrogated in Florida, everybody knows this, a friend of Tamerlan Tsarnaev's, allegedly had confessed and was about to sign a confession or write a confession to the triple murders in Waltham on the 10th anniversary of September 11th, had implicated, allegedly, Tamerlan Tsarnaev. Listen to what's happened in this story. First, we hear immediately after, he had a knife and he lunged at the FBI guy there.
Correct.
Then he had no knife. Then there was a samurai sword in the room. And now the I-Team at Channel 4 reports, well, no, it was none of those things. It was a pole he grabbed and had lunged for the FBI agent. That's one set of inconsistencies. Remember, there were three law enforcement people in the room mm-hmm. at the time of the alleged charging of the FBI agent. Then it went down to one. And in some reports in the last 24 hours, there are actually four law enforcement people there. Continue for a second. The FBI agent, the day after it happened, sustained non-life-threatening injuries. Pretty serious, right? What I read yesterday were some cuts and abrasions. The bottom line is, why does anybody think that we are getting the straight story about anything? And let me finish this one thought.
Okay.
If all of this has been a bundle of contradictions, why should we not be skeptical about whether or not this guy, in fact, had made a confession to the triple murders in Waltham? And when you see the alleged autopsy photos, now they're not authenticated, the photos that the father of Tadashev has allegedly taken by a friend of his in Orlando, where the guy was shot six times, including once in either the top or the back
of
the
head. That was the seventh shot.
Exactly.
Seven shots.
Seven. There are a lot of questions that need answering. And as it's just the bottom line is the lack of transparency about all this stuff is not only putting some of us at risk, I would argue, but is driving me crazy.
So that's another question that we have for you guys, again, at 877-301-8970. What do we do to get answers from the FBI and the Massachusetts State Police about what exactly did happen in this Tadashev's Orlando apartment? And again, I hate to second guess cops, like I hate to second guess soldiers, because the adrenaline is flowing and people are worried about getting killed, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But seven shots seems to me excessive.
In a living room.
When there are more than one, we believe, although the story has changed many times, but we believe that there were at least three or four law enforcement people in a room with one alleged suspect.
Hey, but by the way, let's assume that one of the versions of the story is true, that the only person in the room at the time was the FBI. If you have a guy with a violent past,
right,
who either has access to a samurai sword or a knife or a pole, why is the FBI agent ever alone? And by the way, there may be a reason for this. Do you see my interview with Harvey Silverglade last night?
I'm sorry, Jim.
Well, let me tell you. I mean this seriously, not jokingly.
I was at my book club.
Harvey Silverglade, who's one of the nation's premier civil liberties lawyers, talked about a policy that I had never heard of before. It turns out he wrote about it in the Globe and I had missed it. Do you know that it is FBI policy, not practice, policy and practice, not to record an interview with a suspect. Not to record. So one of the ways that we could answer all these questions about this guy who was shot by the FBI, allegedly after lunging at him with either a knife or a pole or a samurai sword or nothing, one of the ways is if we could hear a recording of what the interview was like. But there is no recording. And I'll tell you, for people who say this kind of skepticism is anti-police rhetoric or anti-law enforcement rhetoric, then you really, in my opinion, don't care about your own freedom and the truth. 877-301-8970. This is driving me out of my mind.
You know what was incredible, too? I mean, because the Whitey Bulger trial is coming up in a couple of weeks, I've been reading all these books about Whitey Bulger. And the FBI shenanigans and downright criminal activities that they were engaged in Boston, you know, with protecting Whitey Bulger and actually allowing people to get killed that were informants and stuff like that. You read in this, you said, I can't believe this. You know, this is the FBI. You know, Elliot Ness, we know J. Edgar Hoover had his difficulties and was going after people that he shouldn't have gone after, et cetera. But you didn't know there was this really terrible, resulting in murders, a consortium with these criminals. And now you say down in Orlando, you think, doesn't the FBI realize that they need to be transparent, that their reputation has still not been rehabilitated, particularly in Boston? And, of course, where do the bombings happen? In Boston.
Yeah,
so,
and by the way,
I'm stunned by the FBI's performance.
And incidentally, there may be decent answers to follow up on your thought to every single issue about the Tedeschev interview or interrogation, whatever it was, in his apartment in Orlando. But at least answer questions. And then add to this the Keating comments from Moscow, which, again, I think are scary.
Excuse me. To me, there should be a joint press conference by the Massachusetts State Police and the FBI explaining this, standing up and answering questions from reporters. Now, obviously, it's an ongoing investigation, and we understand that. We don't want to tamper or hurt that investigation, but they can certainly be more forthcoming. I mean,
how does it hurt an investigation to say he had a knife, he had a samurai sword, he had a pole, he had none of these things? How does that damage an investigation of a guy who is now dead?
Well, this is, to me as a reporter, what the government often does is say it damages an investigation so they can hide behind that as an excuse. Mm-hmm. Or they say it's a confidentiality issue when they can hide behind that as an excuse. Usually they're not forthcoming because they're worried about exposing their malfeasance or their ineptitude or their mistakes or whatever it is. And this whole thing, one last thing before we get to the calls at 877-301-8970, I don't understand why you are repeatedly questioning a suspect in his apartment.
Who's got a violent past.
Yes. Why you don't bring... Now, they say that that this guy, Tedeschev, did not want to go to FBI headquarters. Well, I think that's kind of... You say, you got to go. You got to go. We're not going to debate this. We're the FBI. We're the Massachusetts State Police. You got to go. If you want to get a lawyer, get yourself a lawyer.
Yeah, but can I interrupt you? And by the way, at a press conference, which you want to have happen, and I hope the American people do too, the response may be, Marjorie Egan, with all due respect, you don't know what you're talking about. The reason we wanted it in the House is because it was a comfortable environment for him. He was more likely to talk. But tell us that. The bottom line is there is a man who is dead who could have told us a lot, allegedly,
Jim,
about a triple murder in Waltham. What?
My daughter's ex-boyfriend was stopped by the cops up in Grafton for looking like one of the
story.
Bombers. What did they do with him? They took him down to state police headquarters up there near Grafton. So I find it hard to believe.
No, I'm not saying you're wrong. I'm just saying answer. Maybe you're wrong. You may be wrong. You may be right. Answer the questions. And the other thing I just want to say, and then we will get to the calls, I want to hear every elected official and every intelligence leader in this country respond to what Bill Keating has to say. And you know what worries me, even though I respect Bill Keating? Just like after Ed Davis made those comments about, well, I had members of the Joint Terrorism Task Force. We weren't told anything about the Tsarnaev thing. And then he walked it back. And I'm a big fan of Ed Davis's, but he did walk it back. Do you think by the time Bill Keating lands on American soil, his comments about how this could have been prevented are going to be walked back as well? I mean, this is a pretty incendiary remark by a United States congressman who was met face-to-face with Russian security officials.
Well,
it's pretty dramatic.
The Russians, and again, they're Russian intelligence officials, and I don't know that much about the credibility of them in a general kind of way. I know Vladimir Putin
He's not a dope.
Well, what the Russian intelligence officials are saying pretty unequivocally is that if the United States had acted on their warnings about Tamerlan, you know, he and his mother talking about jihad, his wanting to join this Islamic insurgency, his meeting with this guy, Nidal, who was killed 2 days before Tamerlan possibly getting nervous, hightails it back to the United States of America. I mean, that we would not have had this tragedy on April 11th. And maybe they're right, maybe they're wrong, but I think we deserve a little bit more scrutiny and a little bit, quite a few more answers than we're getting.
Tracy in Hanover, you were first on Boston Public Radio with Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Thank you very much for the call.
Hi, guys. It's nice to hear you guys on the radio again.
Well, thank you.
I just wanted to point out that it's Security 101. You do not leave anybody alone with a suspect in a room, in an office. I mean, that's just common sense. So I don't believe there was just one person in there, because even in something as small as shoplifting, retail, whatever, we never let anybody take anybody into an office by themselves. There always had to be another person in there.
You're not going to get any quarrel from us. But again, in deference to authorities, they should sit in the front of a room and say, With all due respect, Tracy, you have no idea what you're talking about. Here's why. But all we can do is speculate. But Tracy, we are with you. Thanks so much for the call. By the way, Gil in the car called a minute ago and says, why do we keep saying Boston police? Isn't this on Cambridge police? I don't know. I don't know that
Whoops, the Cambridge police were involved in that task force.
Oh, the Joint Terrorism Task Force.
Yeah, I think it was the Boston police that were. I could be wrong about that, but I think it was the Boston police and not Cambridge and not Watertown and not Waltham, et cetera. Let's go to Ahmed from North Andover. What do you think, Ahmed?
Well, I'm just concerned about the fact that we might be oversimplifying. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
By the way, I've been listening to you guys for a while.
Thanks.
I'm just worried that we are oversimplifying the situation by just saying, oh, well, the Russians said something, and now we have not, you know, we dropped the ball. I don't think, if we keep on essentially pushing the police and the state in general and just encouraging them to pay more attention to people, quote unquote, I think we are promoting a situation to allow a more restrictive state police. Because if we, you know, laws will be passed and everybody will be wiretapped, everybody would have cameras in their faces. And what are we going to say then?
Ahmed, let me respond to a couple of things you're saying. It may be the incorrect terminology, but Tamerlan Tsarnaev was not just another person in the country. He was somebody on a terror watch list. That's number one. Two, I'm not basing my concern on reliance on what Russian authorities are saying. I'm basing my concern on Bill Keating, Congressman Keating's analysis of what the Russians told him. He's not a dupe. He's not somebody who's going to go there and just be sort of mesmerized by the rhetoric or the hyperbole of the Russian security people. If he heard what he heard, and he concluded afterwards that prevention of the bombing was beyond a possibility, I think you got to take him at his word, don't you? I'm at least start asking questions.
Well, this is what he's saying, but we don't have any facts, really.
Well, he thinks he does. But again, all we're looking for, and I think I'm speaking for Marjorie here, is a right debate and information. If at the end of the day, the conclusion is Keating was wrong, we couldn't have prevented it. We couldn't realistically have done enough with the information in timely fashion, then I'm perfectly fine with that. What Marjorie and I are objecting to is all the obfuscation, all the lack of transparency. Give us information like grown-ups and let us make some decisions, no?
Well, absolutely. But my biggest concern, however, is for us to complain so much against the police and the FBI and the CIA and all these organizations and then end up promoting laws that will really take off. As you know, once we pass laws, it's very difficult to take them back.
We know that.
So I just don't want us to jump into conclusion here and just push this organization into a situation where next week you're going to have hearings and what have you. Before you know it, you're going to have all these laws passed. And then, before we know it, here we are. Then we're going to again.
We hear you.
You guys are going to be on the radio again and trying to take those laws back.
Hey, but Ahmed, thanks for the call.
I guess to me, in this situation, especially with Tamerlan, that the Russians knew that he was meeting with this guy that I mentioned before, this Nida guy who was a recruiter for Radical Muslim Underground. The Russians were aware that he was meeting with him several times. Now, if in 2011 Tamerlan was suspicious enough that they opened an investigation on him in the United States, and that's what we did.
Well, they actually interviewed him and friends and family in mid-summer 2011.
That's 2011. 2012, he goes to Russia for 6 months. We don't know about it. And what's he doing over in Russia? He's meeting with this guy that's recruiting for the radical Muslim underground.
You don't have to convince me.
I think the least you could do from the American perspective is when Tamerlan comes home, say, What are you doing? What are you doing over there? When he and his mother
couldn't have done that. We misspelled his name, as you know.
And when he and his mother are having conversations about jihad, you might just say, what's up, Tamerlan? You know, and at least apparently she says, the mother says that she knew and he knew that they were being followed by the FBI or looked at by the FBI. But I don't know. This to me is not going overstepping your grounds, going after, you know, any citizen or especially any Muslim citizen.
I think
a lot of Muslims are worried about there's going to be this, you know, over scrutiny of them. This is a guy that was meeting with a bad crowd. Let's put it that way.
Let's go to Barbara in North Scituate, Rhode Island. You're next on Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Thanks for the call, Barbara.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's been a long time since I've talked to you. I have one simple question that may be simple-minded even, but in the Orlando shooting of Kadeshev, in his apartment.
Yep.
It is described. Will you please tell me why one of those shooters of 7 bullets didn't just shoot him in the knees, which would have prevented a table attack and maybe a pole, and they could have finished the interview in the hospital?
Well, also, Barbara, I'll take it one step further. We've asked the question a lot in the last few days. Why not tase him? Why not incapacitate him in some fashion so he was around to tell the story about what happened, allegedly what happened in Waltham?
Apparently, he was confessing. And then why would you want to stop that?
Yeah, I'm suspicious about the confession now, too, though, I got to tell you.
Well, Barbara, their answer, I mean, in defense, again, I'm just stating what the law enforcement people are saying. What their contention is the FBI person felt at great risk. According to this I-Team report this morning from WBZ, the contention was he grabbed the pole, turned over a table. He was shot 3 times, apparently kept coming at the officer, at the FBI agent, and he shot him, at least according to the dead guy's father, 4 more times. So, again, there are a lot of questions, Barb, but I'm totally with you. We've said on the air, why doesn't every officer in that situation have a gun in one holster and a taser in the other? But we don't know. Barbara, thanks for the call. It's
or
good to talk
table.
To you. Or something. Yeah, we got
or
it.
Or a samurai sword,
thank
perhaps.
You. Well, the guy allegedly had one. Barbara, thank you for the call.
We got an email from Sue at bpr@wgbh.org. I think this sort of shows the lack of faith in the FBI because of all the shenanigans that went on during the whole Whitey Bulger years, 70s, 80s, 90s. Sue says, don't trust the FBI in Boston. Too much history to hide.
Well, that is. I mean, by the way, and that skepticism is well-founded. It isn't like there's some anti-FBI animus based on nothing. I mean, this is the history.
No, you know, didn't you used to watch Elliot Ness on TV when you were a kid?
I did, of course.
I mean, who knew?
What was that called again?
Who
it wasn't
knew?
Elliot Ness.
The Untouchables.
The Untouchables. That was great.
That's right.
Great movie. It became a great movie, too.
It was a great movie.
Stanley, you're in Salem, New Hampshire. We're talking about the what happened in that apartment in Orlando and the comments of Congressman Bill Keating saying that, well, let me read him one more time. You can see after he met with the Russian Federal Security Service, you can see with the level of these details that, in fact, if we had better information sharing, there's a very strong chance that things could have changed and the bombings could have been avoided. Hey there, Stanley.
How are you doing today? Thank you for taking my call.
Pleasure.
I wanted to respond to that. And, you know, the FBI, there seems to be a little more FBI bashing and stuff than I would appreciate to hear, mainly because when you're talking about information and people getting information and wanting it now about what they do and about what they know, if they tell everybody what they know instantly, then it wouldn't take very long to find out how they got that information. And having said that, that would make it easier for people with those terroristic tendencies and stuff to be able to hide what they're doing a little bit.
Yeah, but Stanley,
better.
Stanley, neither Marjorie nor I are suggesting there's not a line that shouldn't be crossed. But let's just look at Orlando for a second. Some law enforcement person that could have been the Florida law enforcement person, one of the 2 state troopers from Massachusetts, or the FBI agent has leaked the following 4 stories. There was a knife, there was no knife, there was a samurai sword, and now that there was a pole. That isn't coming from nowhere. That's responsible journalists talking on background to one of these men, I think they were all men, who were in the room. So the reality is they're leaking the information anyway. Stand in front of a room, tell us what you can without compromising your investigation. And we can't force you to tell us what you won't, but at least answer what you can. We agree with you that you don't want to compromise security and you don't want to tip off potential future terrorists, obviously.
That is really some inattention and kind of an adolescent way of thinking on their part, that they're not thinking about in the future, you know, and what they're doing. They seem to be reacting instead of acting.
You know that great line, Stanley? Sunshine is the best disinfectant. It's old, but it is true. Information is a good thing, not a bad thing.
You know,
Stanley, thanks for the call.
Yeah, a good line, Jim.
What is
it's
it?
Not as clever a line, but, you
what
know, when you're claiming self-defense, okay, 1 shot, 2 shots, 3 shots.
7.
But when you get to shot 4, 5... 6 and 7, you know, you seem that's one step beyond the normal kind of self-defense deal. You know what I mean?
Well, but maybe it isn't. This gets back to the whole other thing. Maybe it isn't. But tell us. And again, how does that compromise anything they're doing for a representative of the FBI to say, here's why, assuming he did fire seven shots, we don't even know if he did, he felt the need to fire seven shots.
Well, it looked like, unless these photographs are totally doctored, it did look like more than one wound on the body.
These are the shots, by the way, for those who don't know what the source of this is, the father of Tadashev, if that's how you pronounce his name, the guy was killed in his apartment in Orlando, it showed autopsy photos yesterday and suggested there were six shots to the torso and one to the back or the top of his head. And the photographs suggested that, but they haven't been authenticated by anybody in the United States. Want to take one more, Marjorie?
Paul from Quincy. What do you think, Paul?
On the case in Florida first, where was George Zimmerman when this took place?
Oh, God.
There's
always room for a little
George
humor
Zimmerman
in horrible
was.
Situations.
Well, that trial.
By the way, that's heating up,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, that's heating up, too, and they're putting all these very menacing pictures out of Trayvon Martin
No, actually,
now.
The judge has ruled against the desire of Zimmerman's lawyers
to admit them.
To allow those
but we've
pictures.
Seen them.
We have seen those pictures. Paul, thank you.
Did you have anything else?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
On the heating part, if I can.
Yes.
Sure.
I read the article pretty closely, and it seems to me that our investigative sources, I think, dismissed it because it seemed like such an internal dispute between the Russians and the Chechens that we didn't really care if it was going to be an internal dispute that the Tsarnaev Temer.
Yeah, but Paul, but you know what that's contradicted by? That's contradicted by the fact that law enforcement officials had said, had they not screwed up the spelling, they would have questioned him when he returned to the United
Absolutely.
States after 6 months. So they acknowledge they would have questioned him. They didn't question him because they lost track of him because the federal system doesn't auto-correct a misspelling of a name. What?
They have followed up after that, even if they had spelled it. I got the impression after reading the article, even if they spelled the name right, they were going to dismiss it because this was an internal.
Well, let me read you again what Ed Davis said in front of Congress. Here's a question from the congressman. But if you knew of a Russian intelligence warning that this man was an extremist and may travel overseas, and the fact that he did travel overseas and came back to the U.S., would that not have caused you to give this individual a second look? Boston Police Commissioner Ed Davis's response was one word, and the word was absolutely. Paul, thanks so much for the call.
You going to stay on top of this, Jim?
Well, it's troubling. And it, you know, one of the things that one of the callers said, this, he doesn't want this to devolve, if that's the right word, into just mindless criticism of law enforcement authorities. A lot of the line people did spectacularly courageous work, but that's not where the issue comes in. The issue is in the top levels of information sharing.
The issue is that this very possibly could be our future. This lone wolf or lone wolves in this case, setting off small explosives, and these were obviously big enough to do terrible, terrible damage to 260 people and to kill people as well. But the point is, you want to think that they're on top of those sort of lone wolves types because Al-Qaeda has been decimated. There may not be, let's hope there aren't, any massive twin towers-like explosions, but there could be these things. Who knows how often going forward? And that's why it's significant, because you want to know that they can be prevented if it's possible to prevent them.
Did you read the story of the guy in the last 24 hours who thought he was putting a bomb in a trash can near Wrigley Stadium in Chicago?
Yes.
And what it was a faux bomb that had been given to him by a law enforcement person. But essentially, he thought he was planting a bomb. And the officials out there say, had he in fact done what he wanted to do, he would have caused far more damage than was caused on Boylston Street on April 15th.
It's the homegrown terrorism that I think is very scary as we move forward. And you certainly want to make sure that we're doing everything we can to prevent it. We can't always prevent it, perhaps, but we at least should, it seems to me, be a little bit more forthcoming in how we're trying to prevent it. So, okay, enough about that. We're going to be joined in just a couple of seconds by Callie Crossley. She's with us every Friday at this time. She's going to go over some of the stories that you may have missed this week. Under the Radar with Callie Crossley, up next on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
I am Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan, and you are listening to Boston Public Radio. Every Friday at about this time, give or take a couple of minutes, we're joined in Studio 3 by Callie Crossley. She is host of Under the Radar with Callie Crossley every single Sunday night at 6:30. Callie, welcome back. Great to see you.
Hello, Jim. Hello, Marjorie.
How are you?
Okay. Friday.
So where are we starting with Callie Crossley? I think we're starting with your little sweet friend down there. And,
Kimberly Wilkins is her name, but she's commonly known now as Sweet Brown. This is a woman who was Oklahoma City resident who was captured on film after she ran out of her house that was on fire and was interviewed by a local TV station.
You want to hear a piece of that?
Oh, yes, please.
Everybody,
yeah.
I assume everybody's heard this about 3,000 times.
Well,
it has gone viral. Here she is after having escaped the fire last year. Here's Sweet Brown.
Well, I woke up to go get me a cold pop. And then I thought somebody was barbecuing. I said, oh, Lord Jesus, it's a fire. Then I ran out. I didn't grab no shoes or nothing, Jesus. I ran for my life. And then the smoke got me. I got bronchitis. Ain't nobody got time for that.
That is Sweet Brown, I think in the middle of last year. Is that not right? Sometime in 2012.
Yes, yes.
So what's the latest
There's a controversy
on her?
So what's the controversy?
Well, some clever people, you know, memeified her. So, okay, so that's one level of it. And then others went far enough to put a song together, and then a radio program called The Bob Rivers Show played the song, which then became another hit, and then you could buy it on iTunes, and those people made a profit. And so she's suing Apple, saying, excuse me, I did not give you consent, though Bob Rivers said she did give consent, she did not, to use my likeness and, you know, make a profit off of me, and I should be able to control my own likeness. Adding to that, since she's filed the lawsuit, a local startup has asked her to be its spokesperson. So from a legal standpoint, I'm told, people say she has actually more of a leg to stand on because they're possibly destroying her ability to make money off herself if she wants to.
She's looking for $15 million bucks. Is that not what she's suing
yes.
for? But, I mean, what's the response to the notion, this is a news story. It wasn't a...
No, that part was fine. She's no problem with that. Is that when they took pieces of the news story, made it into something else, this song, which is intercut with, you know, President Obama dancing, a kitten playing on a piano. I mean, it's a whole, you have to see the whole thing. It's ridiculous. And then they played it over and over, and then they said, hey, this is great. We'll put it up on iTunes, and you can buy it.
Well, you know what this reminds me of?
Yeah.
This reminds me, we just talk about this every year, with the kids that play basketball in the NCAA, getting their T-shirts. People make T-shirts with their numbers and their likeness on them, and those kids don't get a dime, and the profits all go to the school.
Yeah, and by the way, if they go out and get a summer job and a dollar from somebody who's a supporter of the university, they get kicked off the basketball team.
Right.
So what's the status? What's the status of
this? So it's going through the courts. It's gone to a higher court now. She has started being a part of this ad for a company called WePay. This is perfect for her. It's payments. It's a payment company that tries to, you know, work with people who have problems getting their money, who take too long to pay. So, of course, she pops up through the ad saying, ain't nobody got time for that. You know, because you should be paying. Takes too long. So that, you know, it looks a little cheesy, frankly, the ad, but that's not the point. The point is she can control her own image and make money. And so we'll see what happens.
Wait. I mean, she also sang that she was Charles Ramsey before Charles Ramsey.
She's not saying that, but I mean, she was, if somebody wants to make a song out of Charles Ramsey being the guy involved in the Cleveland horrific situation and then put it up on iTunes and make a profit. So what's interesting about the Apple piece of it, in which she may lose this piece, is that apparently the law says if the organization takes it down, they may not be liable. So it may rest on how fast they took it down, because they have taken it down. So if you go to iTunes, you cannot get the Sweet Brown song.
Who's the defendant in this thing? Is it? Who's she suing? Is Apple?
Yes, and the Bob Rivers Show.
So do you think if she were to win this lawsuit, do you think the CEO of Apple, Tim Cook, who makes only $1 billion a year, do you think he could afford to pay her whatever award she got from the court?
I think he could settle out of court and shut this down, and that would be fine.
Well, she's also such a hot ticket.
Yeah.
I mean, she's just a riot.
You know, so I mean, it's really, but it is interesting because we're going to see where's the line between just what some people call just good old fun, you know, on the internet to something more where you're making money off of it and the person who's involved and whose likeness you're using gets nothing.
Okay. No. Your next Under the Radar, and this is not that Under the Radar. This is like a big deal when the ballot question came down a few years ago, is bilingual education.
Right. Well,
what's
it was
up?
A big deal in 2002 when that was voted in, what's called sink or swim immersion English. So you're a person who needs to learn English. You speak another language. And it used to be that there was both languages taught, or you had some ability to turn to someone and say, I'm not quite understanding what you say in English. Help me. But that all changed in 2002. There's some limited help for people.
It too, by the way, we should be clear. It would change when the voters of Massachusetts voted to repeal it.
Yes.
The ballot question got 70% of the vote.
Right.
Marjorie was one of the 70%. I was one of the 30%, just so you're aware. I was not for the change. But where is it now?
Well, I think it's one of those situations where it sounds like it ought to work, and it doesn't. So Marcela Garcia, who is a regular contributor to Under the Radar with me, wrote an op-ed for the Boston Globe saying, okay, look at these statistics and tell me we don't need to revisit this. And she got a lot of support from people. 46% of the total student population speaks a language other than English. And here's the worst part is that in Boston public schools, 56% of English language learners graduate. That's statewide. So you're talking about a loss of human capital that's huge. And she profiles a young man that she interacts with in her regular daily goings on who is working as hard as he can, but he has problems in biology, which you don't think about because the whole emphasis is on learn English. But if you can't understand English, let's say, in the English class, then it stands to reason you can't understand it in biology, mm-hmm. where you can't do it. Someone writing in the Commonwealth magazine asked the question for folks to think about it this way. Flip the script, if you will, as the kids say, and imagine that you know English very well and you're in a Guatemalan high school and it's all Spanish and you're taking biology. Okay, now how tough would that be for you if you have basic Spanish? You understand basic Spanish, but that's it. You got to take tests having to do with biology. This is the same situation this young man that Marcela profiles in her piece, and that's what's happening with why these kids can't graduate.
But is anybody on Beacon Hill? I mean, that's the exact same argument I gave unsuccessfully to you on the air, Marjorie.
Well, I'll give you my
11
side.
Years
I'll give
ago.
You my,
yeah.
To me, this is just like rent control because neither side can make reasonable compromises.
Which was also repealed on the ballot.
Which was also repealed on the ballot because the pro rent control people couldn't be reasonable. The anti-rent control people couldn't be reasonable. People got fed up and it went to the ballot and then rent control lost. Mm. This is the exact same thing because
it was
happened,
a yes or no. It was a repeal
yes.
or keep.
Because
no
what happened with bilingual education is that kids by the thousands were graduating from high school unable to speak, read, or write in English. And then they couldn't get jobs. And it was like a disaster. And you saw places like Brookline where my kids went to school. And they did this before, and they still do this now. They pull kids out for an hour, 2 hours, whatever it is, and then throw them back in. And it is hard. It is absolutely hard, but you learn a lot faster. It's harder when you're in high school, like that kid she talked about. But what they need to do, it seems to me, is – and there was also no accountability in bilingual ed when it ran before. So what they need to do, it seems to me, is have some meeting of the minds. Jane Swift, in her defense, and other people, there were three bills tried to pass to make some reasonable compromises in bilingual ed, and they got nowhere. So that's what I think needs to happen, because to say to go back to the system as it was before,
well,
that was
a
disaster too.
But I think let me quote my girlfriend who coaches executives at high level institutions. You don't have enough data at the time of 2002, perhaps. You got the data now.
Yeah.
Here's what's happening. They're not able to grasp it. So something else has to happen. So those people who perhaps were on the side where it has to be all or nothing can see evidence now. If you've got 56% of people not graduating, and if this young man is trying his best, because he, by the way, wants to be a doctor, so it's in his interest to pass biology, and he's working as hard as he can, and some things are eclipsing him, this is something to think about.
But is there any way?
I was just thinking about my own nephew, who speaks fluent Japanese. He started teaching himself at 13. Then we sent him to immersion camp. But you know what? That's all he did was learn Japanese.
Yeah.
It's a different scenario if all you're doing is focusing on one thing than if you're every day have a different a whole list of classes you have to go to, and you're trying to figure out, oh my God, okay, well now what do I do over here in biology, and what do I do over here in math, and what do I do over here in English? I mean, that's a different thing.
So this is a fine, relatively well-informed debate between three people in the studio. Is
among
there any indication
among? We
know
something that's interesting, though. We should point out in Boston that the majority of valedictorians are not Americans. Mm-hmm. So a lot of them are doing...
Or they may be Americans, but they weren't born in this country.
They're foreign, they're non-English speakers. And it's year after year after year, and you say to yourself, it was one year, I remember, there were 19 high schools, and 17 of them were kids that came from different countries. Remember, one of them came with a Cambodian boat person that came over.
But here's my point was that while we're having this debate, you're going to have this debate in your show, there's no evidence that anybody on Beacon Hill has any interest in this.
Well, apparently there's more conversation about it now for the very reason I said that as the data has come in, people are saying, well, wait a minute now. We got to look at this and say, you know, what can we do that's more nuanced than just all or nothing?
We should ask the governor's going to be here Thursday at noon. Yeah. We should ask the governor
people
where he is on this.
People have to be reasonable. Yeah. And that's the thing. Everybody gets dug in, just like in rent control, and then you get these...
I think the fact that it's called sink or swim is pretty bad. I mean, I think there needs to be something in there that indicates that you could be saved with a life raft or something.
Hey, speaking of Beacon Hill, you also have a concern about this summer jobs program for teens. And before you get into this, by the way, you know, people are celebrating Tom Menino on his way out the door. One thing that he has been great about is urging is probably too weak a word. The private sector, big corporate executives to put up or shut up. Basically say, if you want to help this city, you want to help kids, you want to deal with crime and all this sort of stuff, then give these kids. I've been in rooms where he's been talking, this is years ago, talking to corporate executives, and this guy is excoriating them for, you know, rhetoric versus reality. But obviously there's a government component too, which is the piece that you want to talk about.
Right. And by the way, I would use the word shaming some of those companies.
Well, he's come pretty close to that.
Shaming some of those companies. So my point is, and this is a part of the commentary I'm doing for Monday, is that we have a surplus. Nobody knew we were going to have a surplus, but we got one. There are some things that we have to put money back in, I think, that's a no-brainer.
We're talking hundreds of millions of dollars in surplus.
$510 million at April's end, though. You know, Steve Grossman, our state treasurer, would say, okay, we still have some bills to pay. But the bottom line is still got a surplus. So there's money to do some things. You got to put some money back in local aid because we took it out to make the budget. So put that back so people can have their fire and police protection in parks and schools. And there are other things that seem to me that we have to deal with and put something in rainy day. But now let's look at where we can have the most impact, in my opinion. And if you have a particular small summer program that's targeted to very low income teens, 5,000 teens, the total budget is $9 million. Right now, the legislators in both houses, both their versions of the bill, cut this program in half. And this is demonstrated that it works. Not only does it reduce crime, it gives these kids some income, sometimes for their entire families. They're the only people working, not because the parents are lazy. Just want to clarify that. They cannot find work. And they learn vital skills. And more importantly, there was a study done that was supported by a State Street Foundation and the city to look at, which was directed by Dr. Gier Barboza, who is a professor at Northeastern University, looking at whether there was really a link between summer jobs and a reduction of crime. And she says carefully in her piece, I was a skeptic when I went into this, but yes, the study did prove, yes, it does reduce crime. So if we're going to be
You don't have time. You're at work.
Exactly. That's my point.
Robbing people,
that is
shooting
exactly
people.
My point.
You know, the good news for the advocates on this is it's short money. It's single-digit millions. Yeah. The bad news is, you know what's happening on Beacon Hill? Once this surplus appeared was after the House voted for $500 million in a tax increase. The Senate voted for sort of a couple hundred million more. And what is being said by most people on Beacon Hill, I haven't heard them say no to what you're talking about. What they've said is, okay, we got to put back out some of the local aid money. But why are we raising taxes, hundreds of millions of dollars, new taxes, if it turns out we just found $500 million.
I've heard that too.
And, you know, it's a lot easier for a legislator to say, well, that tax increase I voted for now is unnecessary because there's a surplus in revenue. So I worry, even though it's short money and even though I think there are very few people, Republicans or Democrats, who would say it's not a worthwhile program, I worry that the focus is going to be getting out of that tax situation that a lot of legislators find themselves in and worry about when they have to go back and run for re-election.
Of course, they're going to try to figure that out. But what gets me is that both versions of the budget bills, which are now being merged as we speak, you know, everybody signed off on hacking this program. And you're like, huh?
Yeah.
Like, come on. Because this is what makes me angry about this stuff. They go to the weakest places to make some of these cuts. I get it if everybody has to take a hit. If local aid took a hit, maybe you have to come back to me and say, if local aid took a hit, well, we got to cut this too. But now we know that they're going to put that some of that money back to local aid. I mean, they're just going to have to. So come on.
Remember the CETA jobs? The Fed used to do that. Everybody I knew had CETA jobs in the summertime. Comprehensive Employment and Training Act. That was back in the 80s.
It pays off so many ways. Mm-hmm. It pays off so many ways in less time to deal drugs
in the park if you had to go teach kids basketball.
Well, it's just, it really, as Dr. Barbosa's study found out, that actually, even beyond the summer, there is great impact on these kids. Like, you know, you get a whole lot for your money in the summertime, but beyond that, they take with them.
You learn job skills.
Yes.
I mean, that was the, exactly. I mean, growing up, I mean, that was the big thing. You had to show up at a certain time. You had to work until a certain time. You had to, you know, be responsible. I mean, it was a good thing.
Listen, Oprah was calling out a young woman who graduated from Harvard yesterday in that class, who at one time was bathing herself in, Walmart bathrooms because she was homeless and didn't have anything. And she's sitting in the class, just graduated, 2013 of Harvard. So we know what can happen with some support. So these are kids. Youth Works is the program. $9 million. Come on, legislators. Put it back. Fund it fully.
Can I propose one alternative, which I think is pretty creative, if I say so myself? Mm-hmm. I was suggesting a couple of minutes ago that if Sweet Brown won her lawsuit, Tim Cook should pay for that out of his $1 billion. Maybe Tim Cook from Apple can pay for this, too.
That would be good. He could pay for
a lot
of stuff.
Can you be in touch with him?
He could pay for a lot of programs.
Kelly Crossley, thanks so much. It's great to see you.
And Kelly Crossley, you can hear every Sunday night, as you guys know, on Under the Radar with Kelly Crossley, 6:30 on Sunday night. Kelly, thank you again.
Thank you.
Okay, the Boston Strong Benefit Concert was last night. Edgar B. Herwick III joins us to go over the good and the not-so-charitable good vibrations that came out of the event. That conversation is next. Boston Public Radio, WGBH 89.7.
This whole building is based on technology and integration.
In an increasingly digital world, cities are striving for more efficiency.
We get to know what's happening faster, and we can put our teams on the street to respond faster.
A series on urban innovation from the NPR Cities Project begins today on All Things Considered from NPR News.
This afternoon at 4 here on 89.7 WGBH.
This program is made possible thanks to you and the Massachusetts Teachers Association, reminding everyone that adults play an important role in encouraging children to read. Reading is the key to success, so read to your children every day and encourage them to love books. And Seasons 4, the outdoor living store in Lexington, featuring a large selection of plants, statuary, and garden accessories, plus over 100 styles of outdoor furniture, on Mass Ave in Lexington and online at seasons4.com.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Obviously, huge night at the Boston Garden last night. Boston's Strong Concert with some of Boston and America's biggest stars. We're going to play some of the high notes and talk about some of the, I guess you call them, sour notes with our colleague, the man behind or on top of or under the curiosity desk.
Under.
Whatever it is. I mean, you're near the curiosity.
It's a Friday.
It doesn't matter where it is.
It's time on Fridays, for you to
I'm
get
under.
Out from under that desk.
Edgar
B.
Herwick III. Hey, Edgar, how are you?
Good. How are you guys?
Great.
Very good. So, okay, let's hear some of the good parts, some of the great sound bites from last night.
What was
night?
The best music?
Music?
What was the best? What was really great?
I mean, honestly, I think my favorite part, music-wise, was the Dropkick Murphys, who were a late addition. You know,
really?
they were sort of a last-minute addition, and they were flown out there. Ernie Bach sent
Did Ernie
his plane.
Do it?
Yeah, that's the word
Junior.
On the street, is that Ernie Bach Jr. Right. Sent his plane to pick them up, and they came out and they said, you know, we were supposed to play tonight in Albuquerque. And they first of all, they thanked the people of Albuquerque.
Wait, is that, they were supposed to play last night in Albuquerque?
Yes, they were supposed to play last night in Albuquerque, New Mexico. And they said, we're thanking the people there who let us move our concert a month so we could be here. But basically, because they just had to hop on a plane, they couldn't bring their whole sort of gear with them, all of their instruments. So they played this really stripped down acoustic set, three songs.
Oh, nice.
Really cool. And then, of course, they finished by having a band come out and playing a little bit of, you know, one of the iconic Boston songs of the last 15 years. Let's hear a little of that. And the crowd goes wild.
That's By the great. Way, this is a stripped-down version
no,
of
this,
the
well, they br- No, they brought a band out for this one. After
that was great.
But it was totally set up by the fact that they played this quiet three songs, and they were like, we can only play three songs. And then this is kind of like the weirdest part of the entire night. They bring out, they're like, we're going to bring out some special guests, and you're waiting, you're thinking, who's it going to be? Is it maybe going to be Aerosmith? Is it maybe going to be James Taylor? And they're like, ladies and gentlemen, the New Kids on the Block! And of all of the acts
drop
you expect,
kicks and the New Kids.
So the New Kids on the Block That's come great. Prancing out in these, like, bedazzled Bruins jerseys, and they're all screaming and hooting and hollering, shipping up to Boston. Neat. It was really kind of a great moment. So that was a great musical moment. And
I only heard a little bit. By the way, I have to say my streaming was not quite what I would hope it would be.
That was a little bit of an issue. That was not you. That was a little bit of an issue across the board. They were having trouble with the stream, and they had it fixed by the end of the concert, but for a long time, they were having serious problems. Some people couldn't see it at all. Some people, it was skipping.
You know what I did hear, and I know it's on your list as well. I heard a little bit of Jay Giles.
They killed it.
And
they
not
were
only
awesome.
Was the music great. I mean, how great. It's almost like they're in their 20s again. They looked so fabulous. It was unbelievable. So you have a little bit of that.
Let's
to
hear
play
a little
too?
Bit of Jay Giles.
I actually don't know if we heard a little bit of Jay Giles. We're having a sound
technical
problem,
difficulty.
But let's assume we did for a second. And Aerosmith, we spoke. I want to play this too. We spoke to Tom Hamilton yesterday. Yeah. Tom Hamilton is obviously the bassist for the band. I thought he was just terrific, and he made a point that we have talked about here. But it matters a lot more when you're in Aerosmith than when you're a radio talk show. Let's listen to a little bit of Hamilton when he was kind enough to join us yesterday before the concert.
I'm concerned for a lot of these people that, you know, someday all the excitement's going to die down.
Yeah.
And, people aren't going to be talking about it quite so much. And that's when these people, I think, are going to need the most support.
Amen.
So it really needs to be a sustained effort to help out and, you know, really help these people to be able to follow through on their feelings of the idea that the future is going to be good.
You know, I'm so glad to hear him say that, because there's so much euphoria over how people have come to the support of the 260 people who are injured, some of them losing a limb or two limbs or whatever. But him focusing on the fact that there is a future here. When there's not a Boston Strong concert, when there's not a television camera, when they're not front page stories in the Globe and the Herald about your they got. I was visiting a friend the other day at Spalding.
Yeah.
And while I was there, a ton of the people who were in rehab at Spalding who lost a limb at the marathon are there with their families or their friends or the people they love. And you get a totally different sense of what the real world is going to be like.
God.
You know, you see Jeff Bowman, for example, who's this incredible guy, the guy that was rescued by Carlos Arredondo. No legs. He's on the Bruins ice. And then he threw out the first pitch with Carlos the other night. He's got a life with no legs. And while last night there was great celebration of him and all the others, I thought the fact that Hamilton said, we got to, you know, sort of stay the course here was a terrific thing. Well, there was some controversy last night, too. We're going to play you more music in a couple of minutes. But we want to hear from you on this. Dane Cook. Actually, he was supposed to be with us yesterday. He stood us up.
That's
Putting
right.
that aside, which I will get over, Dane Cook, the comedian, born in Cambridge, grew up in Arlington, graduate of Arlington High School. You were at the press conference yesterday where he spoke, right?
I was. And he, you know, he was one of, there was a handful of artists who spoke before. The New Kids on the Block came out, the guys from Extreme, and then Dane Cook. And everybody was sort of saying the right things and talking about how excited they were to be there, how special the night was going to be. And I want to play a little bit of what Dane Cook had to say at the press conference, and then talk a little bit about what happened when he actually got to the stage.
I was also reaching out, basically just putting out the feelers back east and saying, like, what can I, you know, what do you need? What, you know, is there something you need, like a cleanup crew? Is there anything that I can do? I'll sling burgers, you know, whatever I can do to, you know, be a part of it. And fortunate moment where they contacted me back and said, you know, we could use some laughs. And I said, well, good, that I can do. So here we are.
So Dane Cook joins the all-star cast, Edgar. Everybody's feeling great about it. And then all of a sudden last night, Dane Cook tweets out the following, which obviously changed everything. Do you have the tweet in front of you?
I have the tweet. Hey, everybody. Sorry my set was not a part of the live stream or televised. I didn't want any of the new material to hit the airwaves yet.
Yeah.
Okay. I think that's just awful. What happened to sling burgers, whatever
you
need?
He's willing to sling burgers, yeah, but not to share new material with the thousands of people who are watching live online from all over the world.
Wait, just let me just be clear. So while everybody is watching the streaming of, I would assume, performers who are a little bit bigger than Dane Cook, from the Aerosmiths to the James Taylors,
Jimmy Buffett,
to all these people, they are fine, yep, with their performance streaming, but the screen goes dark when Dane Cook is, yep, doing his routine.
And by the
because
way,
because he doesn't want anybody to hear, other than the 20,000 people there, virtually all of whom are probably taping the thing anyway.
Absolutely.
He doesn't want any to share his new
routines.
He looks like
a total jerk.
And here's the thing. He was not the only comedian there. Stephen Wright did material.
Our buddy Steve Sweeney was there.
Steve
Sweeney
did material. Lenny Clark did a whole set, which was clearly custom done for this event. You know, he had a whole bit about, you know, the word shelter in place and the confusion about what it means. And he did a whole bit about the scene in Watertown. I mean, he had constructed an entire set, you know, based on what had happened. So
what's this guy's deal? Is he normally a jerk, or is this aberrational for him? Or
well,
what?
I mean, he has earned a reputation over the years as a bit of a jerk.
Okay, so he's true to form.
Let me just say, I interviewed him for Boston Common Magazine 4 or 5 years ago, and he actually was great in the interview. So I don't know what he's like in real life. Obviously, it was not life. He was going to be on the cover of the magazine. He was happy about it. But we want to know at 877-301-8970. Everybody was on a high, either whether you were there last night or not there, about this incredible event. All these performers dedicated their time for nothing, as Tom Hamilton told us on the air yesterday from Aerosmith. What's your reaction to Dane Cook saying, I'm the special one. My content cannot be streamed to those poor souls at home because I don't want to preclude people from hearing my new stuff when I go on my concert
tour. Remember the great 9/11 concert that every big star was at? Your buddy Billy Springsteen
Billy Crystal,
was there.
The
whole thing.
Absolutely.
Can you imagine if one of those singers got up there and said, if Bruce Springsteen got up there and said, you know,
It's a new song.
Sorry. You can listen to the old songs, but you can't play the new songs. People would just, he'd be eviscerated.
So what's your reaction? 877-301-8970. I want to throw another gripe in. And by the way, it doesn't take at all away from the brilliance of the performers, their willingness from the Dropkicks to everybody else to do this thing and interrupt their schedules for an incredibly good cause. The other thing that drove me, I got a call from my boss yesterday from NECN.
Yeah.
And she said she was hoping that she would be able to broadcast live the concert last night. Now, I'll give you the short version of the conversation. I said, well, why should that be a problem? The thing is sold out. It's a charity. I assume in between performances, your anchors, our anchors at NECN, are going to say, please give money to one fund boss. And so they'll raise additional dough. They weren't allowed to do it.
By the way, they're letting everybody live stream it on their website for free.
But not only did I think it was a wonderful thing to do for the viewer, not to mention for the One Fun Boston, you know, there are a lot of people, particularly older people, who are not doing the streaming who frankly watch television but don't go on their computers. There's some people in the lower end of the income spectrum who are not doing the computer thing either. I was stunned that the answer was, I understand if it's a real concert. I don't mean a real concert. I mean a concert where it's part of a commercial tour. That's fine. Yeah. I understand. This, with the sole purpose was to raise money for the victims. So did you?
I talked to Don Law about it.
Don Law
is the legendary promoter. He's Live Nation. He basically is Live Nation in New England. He is one of the guys responsible for pulling this whole thing together. And I talked to him yesterday about it.
You talked to him about this?
I asked him about it.
And what was the answer?
I said, why isn't it being televised? And he sort of basically said, you know, we looked at it, we thought about it, but it would have involved doing some configuration in the venue. It would have involved more lighting. We might have lost a few seats, and we're trying to raise as much money as we can. So we just decided to go with the live streaming.
What could raise more money? What is he talking about?
Not to mention that fact,
I was stunned. I think I had this conversation with you this morning. I thought the quality of the stream when
it was
working was incredibly good. So if it was decent enough for streaming, the notion that one, it wouldn't have been good enough for television is preposterous. And frankly, you don't think the viewer would have said to him or herself, I understand this is a charitable effort, so if the quality of the video...
They would have run the Chiron. They would have run the Chiron underneath. contribute to the one fund Boston.
If they would have run it the whole time, which they did on the stream. On the stream, you know, they had text, you know, this number to give $10. They had call to give, you know, to give money to this event. You've seen these before. The 12-12-12 concert for Sandy. Mm-hmm. You know, that aired on television.
That's a very
and,
good point.
And that was not the greatest television production you've ever seen. But, you know, you kind of, you know what you're watching. So you accept it.
Tom from Lowell just emailed in, Dane Cook is cooked.
Well, I hear, I mean, you should read some, not you, some of the tweets.
I have some of the tweets.
Oh, you do?
These are great. There are some really good ones here. Here's one of my favorites. This was Adam Frawley tweeted, Dane Cook, at Dane Cook. Really? Why do a new set at a charity show? Couldn't you just steal some of Louis C.K.'s jokes like you usually do?
That's pretty.
There you go. Paul Kelly tweeted, it's your acting career that you should have never let hit the airwaves. Just another.
And by the way, most of them are unreadable. So we want to know two things. One, if you saw the streaming or happened to have been there, what'd you think of the concert? The reviews of the concert itself have been spectacular. What's the reaction, one, to the Dane Cook decision not to allow his performance to be streamed? And don't you think that Don Law and the other people behind this should have allowed My Place, NECN, and others to broadcast this, both for financial reasons and to make sure it had the widest possible audience? I just don't get it. 877-301-8970 is our number.
It could just be total short-sightedness, I should say, on Don Law's part, although he seems like he's been doing this long
time. He's one of the biggest promoters in the world. What are you talking about?
It's tough to give him a hard time just because, you know, the effort's good. They're trying to raise money, and you know that everybody's got full-time jobs, and they're doing everything they can to kind of do this last minute on top of it. So, you know, maybe it's like you're sort of suggesting, maybe it's a hindsight is 2020 thing, and maybe they should have done it. But my sense is, you know, I go back to the fact that we've seen these kinds of concerts before. The 9/11 concert.
Right.
The, you know, the 12-12-12 concert for Sandy. The one recently for weather disasters, you know, in the Midwest. So I think that the idea that television wasn't on the table from the beginning is sort of odd. So maybe there's some other reason. Who knows if the contract that they have with the artists when they first started.
They should have said that.
But they should have said it. Exactly. I totally agree.
877-301-8970. We can talk about the high notes, the sour notes, whatever you want. Give us a buzz. You can email us at bpr@wgbh.org. Everybody with whom I've spoken who actually was in the place said the music was spectacular. Yes?
Yeah, it was surprisingly good. I would say that what I keep saying is it was a lot like watching a playoff game. You know how players kind of raise their game? A playoff game might not be the best sporting game you've ever seen, but everybody's trying a little extra hard. And there was really that sense that every one of the artists that got out there, it was really meaningful for them. They were trying really hard. You know, they had 300 first responders and victims in the front rows. And you can see that, and that was courtesy of.
How was Carole King? I'm sorry, I interrupted you.
No, that's
courtesy
okay. Courtesy of David Mugar.
Who
bought the 300 tickets for those folks, which is a pretty cool move.
Pretty cool move.
You know what else was interesting is a lot of the artists seem to have relationships with these victims, and you hope, as Tom Hamilton was suggesting, that they sustain that over time. Both the artists and some of the people who talked in between, like sporting people, like Doug Flutie and others. But to get back to your thing, Carole King was terrific.
Good. Loved to
she
hear
was
that.
Great.
And
she
our buddy Matty Siegel opened the whole
Matty
thing up
Siegel.
With a lot
he's,
of the victims.
He's terrific. Brian Matty from Boston. Siegel, what do you think about Dane Cook saying, you can't play my stuff? Hi, Brian.
Hi, Brian.
You there, Brian?
Brian is breathing hard. That's all I know. We're going to put you on hold for a second,
he's
Brian. We'll get back
Dane
to
Cook.
You in a second. Let's try Lee and Gardner. Lee, you're on Boston Public Radio. Edgar, Jim, and Marjorie. Hey, Lee. We continue to have technical problems. We'll put you on hold,
issue.
Too. We'll get to you
technical issue.
In a couple of seconds. And you know what I remember? I hope I got this all right, and if not, Marjorie particularly can correct me. Do you remember when Deval Patrick, the day the casino bill, the first casino bill, was going to be voted on, I think I got this right, in the House of Representatives, what did he do that day? Do you remember?
Deval Patrick?
Yeah, he went to New York City to sign his
first book
contract.
His book deal, yes.
And Joan Vinocki in the Globe, I hope I got all this right, wrote a great column saying, wasn't there somebody to stand in the door and say, Governor, Deval, you can't do this. Yeah. The casino bill is one of your major things. That's how I feel about this Dane Cook thing. Is there nobody in Dane Cook's life who was able to say to him, hey, Dane, this really is not going to play terribly
idea.
Well. And by the way, we were talking to Callie about this. Callie Crossley a minute ago. And
she's,
you know,
she's with him.
Well, because she says he has a right. He has, he owns his own property.
And so does every one of those artists.
That's my response. If there had been other people who'd said, I'm sorry, you just can't play this stuff. When every single other artist, Aerosmith is one of the biggest bands in the world.
Absolutely.
When they all say, do whatever you want with this. Who the hell is Dane Cook to say he's some sort of special character?
Oh, since we can't get the phone calls, technical difficulties. We're trying to fix that soon. We are getting some emails on this. Jeff says that Dane Cook just doesn't want the world to see that he does the exact same material at every show.
So, I mean, there is another side to it, right? And we sort of see it. And we have a good conversation going on our Facebook page right now about this. And one of our listeners, one of the people who commented on Facebook, Tom Ginder, he said, no one says when going to a concert, I've heard those songs before. But with comedy, people don't go because they've heard those jokes before. It's great that he chose to do new material for a live audience. And if there's a backlash, I think he may have been better off refusing, reusing some of his best old material. We'll see. But he supports that he didn't give the broadcast rights. I mean, I sort of get it from that perspective. But again, my feeling on it is there's a time and a place for everything.
Yeah.
And all these other comedians figured out a way
a
to
tragedy
do it.
Hey,
and not
fundraiser.
To mention, you know, before at that press conference, in addition to saying he would sling burgers and everything, Dane Cook went on and on about how he gave a lot of thought to this material and he gave some consideration to this material because it was a very important and special night. And so if you gave that much thought to it, why didn't you think about putting together some material that could be broadcast as part of the live stream?
I have to say, there's some days when we're about to go on the air when I feel that my cleverness quotient is going to be so high that I turn to Margie and I say, I don't know if I want to waste this from 12 to 2.
Totally.
I really want to, I want to be able to use
it
in future
it
forums
for free.
And
that's
that
right.
Sort of.
Yeah.
But, you know, just to wrap this thing up, because the memory of this should not be Dane Cook and the failure to allow a broadcast. The memory of this is some of the biggest stars. I love the fact that there's this Boston connection. I saw an interview last night on Piers Morgan with Wahlberg. What's a Wahlberg from?
Donnie Wahlberg.
Donnie Wahlberg. Yeah. And it was so emotional and real to me.
Yeah.
James Taylor was interviewed by Piers Morgan and his wife. And when they talk about Boston, and that's the beauty of this. I mean, it's great. They're all great performers.
Yeah.
But the fact that even Dane Cook, before he did what he did, talks about Boston is my hometown. This is where I'm from. All that stuff is, to me, really, really powerful. And the fact that they all decided, with this one exception, to donate all of their time to a spectacular cause really created a great feel, and I hope for at least one night made a lot of the people who suffered a lot on April 15th pretty happy.
Yeah, and I agree. And it should be said that in addition to the artists who donated their time, Don was telling us that a lot of other was telling us that a lot of other folks did too. Hotels in the area, people who were doing transportation of equipment, and this one I really love, a lot of the crew members, the guys, the roadies and things like that, and these guys certainly don't make the kind of money that the artists make. And the fact that they were also, a lot of those guys were donating their time, I think speaks volumes about
it's
an
really
effort
great.
Like this. So
I just
want
to sum up the email since we weren't able to take the calls.
What do we got?
People are calling Dane Cook names that I cannot repeat on the air. Let's just sum it up that way. Edgar B. Herwick III is the man behind the Curiosity Desk. Edgar, thank you very much
Always
for being with us.
Always a pleasure.
See you under the Curiosity Desk later, Edgar. I'll be down there with you about 2:15.
Okay. So, what do AAA hot weather of intelligence leaks have in common? Excuse me. Emily Rooney has something to say about all of them. Open Mic with Emily Rooney is up next on Boston Public Radio.
I'm James Edwards. I live here in Brighton, and I report here in Boston. Well, I do this because of the accountability.
The Chamber's salary is far and away the highest in the state. And I would say that one of the reasons for that is that it is the largest, probably most complex, urbanized environment in the state that has a city manager form of government.
Me sticking with journalism is sort of the work and kind of that sense of public good in a way. James Edwards, WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
This program is on WGBH thanks to you and Newbury Court, a full-service residential community for persons over the age of 62. Newbury Court in Concord, Massachusetts. You can schedule a visit any day of the week by visiting newburycourt.org. And Fruitlands Museum, 4 historic exhibition buildings and over 200 acres of meadows and trails. Now through June, presenting Visions, Tim Hetherington, a photojournalism exhibit. More at fruitlands.org.
You're listening to Boston Public Radio, Jim Browdy and Marjorie. And you know, one thing we gripe about a lot, you've already heard it today, particularly with Emily, is about transparency, the need for more government transparency. Well, in the spirit of not being hypocritical ourselves, we're going transparent. We recorded our open mic with Emily Rooney yesterday. We talked about the shooting of Ibrahim Todashev. Of course, today we know more about details than we did yesterday, but the thrust of the conversation we had is still totally relevant. So here's open mic with Emily Rooney.
So when we first heard about this Todashev fellow down in Orlando who apparently implicated himself and Tamerlan Tsarnaev in the Waltham triple murder, yeah. We heard that he was shot after he lunged at either one of two state troopers or the FBI guy with a knife. Now the Washington Post is reporting there was no knife. What are we to make of this?
I mean, the thing was suspect from the beginning. The idea that they killed him, even if he did have a knife. You know, they could have shot him in the legs. I mean, how did this come about?
Well, so 3-1, three cops, three law enforcement people in this guy.
Plus, multiple gunshots we're learning now, at least according to sources, including one in the back of the head. The medical examiner hasn't confirmed that, but that's what we're hearing according to friends and family.
You know, the worst part of this is the secrecy of our government. It's just, it really is an outrage. We should have at least some kind of an accounting of this. If this were the state police or a Boston police department, they're secretive enough, but we would have some accounting. It's been, 2 weeks already?
Well, you know, so there was a knife and then there wasn't a knife. There was a confession, but then we learned from the New York Times it was only oral. It was not recorded. There was nothing signed in writing. So I hate to be the skeptic, but if the gun existed and didn't, the knife existed and then didn't, why should we believe that there's in fact a confession and arguing that Tamerlan Tsarnaev was involved in the thing also?
Exactly. And the mother says that the FBI had told him that they weren't coming back to interview him anymore, that the interviews were done, that he was clear.
This is Todashev's mother, yeah.
Yes. And then they came back that day for one more interview. But why were they interviewing at his house? Why
exactly.
Did they bring him in
question.
Somewhere?
Well,
especially
since he has a violent record. He has a violent history, so they know there's that potential. Why do you interview him in that sort of setting?
And the whole thing is bizarre. Usually in a situation like this, if you think the cops suspect you of being involved in a triple murder, what's the first thing you do? You get a lawyer.
Great point.
And you go down to the – and if they're going to talk to you, they take you down to police headquarters or the FBI office or something like that, and you're there with your lawyer. This was the oddest thing I've ever heard. But you know what happens to us in the media in a lot of these cases when there's these horrible tragedies? The love fest for the police becomes overwhelming. And when you say anything, question anything, like those people who questioned the masses of police who went into Watertown after the bombings, you're viewed as unpatriotic or a bad American or something.
I couldn't agree more.
We cheerlead.
And this whole thing about the only way you can get information, and it's our job to go pursue this stuff, but the only way you can get it is through a leak. And here you've got the administration, the Obama administration, running around trying to plug all these leaks. But if you just gave us the information, we wouldn't need to be doing it. So we don't know, for instance, what exactly is true, the stuff that's coming out this week, that he was unarmed, that there was three people in the room and he was being – we don't really know any of the details. Why not? How come we don't know anything about Jokhar Tsarnaev either?
And let's add one more thing to this list. And I don't know if this is aberrational. You're more a student of journalistic history, clearly, than I am, Emily. But have the Waltham cops or Waltham authorities or elected officials said one word? I mean, we know what happened on 9/11, 2011. We know that there was arguably sketchy follow-up in terms of the media. I guess in great part because it was the 10th anniversary of 2011, if you go of 9/11.
It wasn't just that.
But since – wasn't just what?
It wasn't just that it was the 10th anniversary of 9/11.
Drug deal going bad.
Exactly. And that's something else that we do not do very well in the media. If there's some sort of line where the cops say – the dead person was known to police, then we don't give it as much weight.
Yeah, so since there have been implications, I think Resendez may have been the first person to write this in the Globe, I'm not sure if I'm right, about the fact that both Tamerlan Tsarnaev was a suspect, if that's the proper terminology, in the Waltham triple murders after the marathon, and maybe his younger brother, because the implication, at least from some unnamed sources, was one man could not do what the damage that was done to three individuals. They didn't shoot them, as we all know. They slit their throats and all that sort of stuff. why have we heard nothing? And again, I am respectful and understanding. If there's certain things you can't say, a pending investigation, fine. Tell us what you can tell us about Tedeschev. Tell us what you can tell us about the Waltham triple murders. There is no reason at this moment to believe that Tedeschev was involved in these killings.
To that unbelievable press conference that Jeffrey Locke had when they picked up Greiniter, you know, the Dr. Greiniter. He went on for 40 minutes. Possibly jeopardizing the case, but every detail they had, why they picked that guy up and why they were charging him with murder. That's all. We're just asking for
the basics. Well, you know, we mention this almost every time we're having this comparable discussion with you, Emily, is the moment I remember most like that was during the savings and loan crisis when John McCain, younger John McCain, he was not one of the key problematic senators, but he was on the periphery of it. He did one of those press conferences where he said, I'm going to stay here until every single question has been asked and answered. And he did. And again, I'm respectful, whether it's Ed Davis, whether it's DeLaurier, who has totally disappeared, the head of the FBI, since those photographs came out of the two brothers on that Thursday night of the marathon bombing, or the Waltham authorities, or it's the FBI from Orlando, Florida. Say something.
Exactly.
Give us what you
can give
us.
And there's
got to
be a follow-up, Marjorie. You just mentioned that shootout in Watertown. They fired 200 rounds. It was willy-nilly. And I know this is hindsight, and people were just so excited that night that they even got the guys, but that was reckless, reckless behavior.
The Atlantic Online did this incredible piece. I've mentioned this to Jim before. Just a series of pictures of police officers going into the homes and getting people out of there. And I don't know why people were running out of there with no shoes on from their homes, carrying their children. I understand that it was a tense situation, but it was police officers in different kind of outfits, you know, blue attack outfits and green attack outfits. It was a very scary, scary scene. And you know, you haven't heard much from the civil libertarians about this either. But again, I think it's because you're viewed as being somehow
anti-American,
out of line. Yeah, absolutely out of line. And you know, in this case, in this Orlando case, I said this before, but if it's correct, and the friend that washed his body, according to Muslim tradition, the guy down in Orlando that was killed by the cops, he says he was shot in the back of the head.
Really?
Now, that is very problematic. Again, we don't know. That's just a friend, and we don't know. And the medical examiner has not helped the situation by not releasing the results of their autopsy, which they should have done by now. But if that's so, that's a real problem.
We agree. I'm taking a deep breath because it is so aggravating, and it can be fixed relatively easy. Well, from Tedeschev to a little bit, I guess, less serious matter locally. The other night you had Tim Murray, I believe the only broadcast interview he has done since his resignation
on TV.
And here is a little piece of Tim Murray and Emily Rooney.
Media outlets were visiting every bar, restaurant, hotel, calling my neighbors to ask if I was having marital problems. I mean, it surprised me. Quite frankly, I wish it didn't happen. I feel badly about the distraction that it's caused. I can assure you and tell you unequivocally, I was not on the phone with anybody. It wasn't texting. This was an accident.
Okay.
So you do the best you can, and you know, knowing you're not going to satisfy everybody.
That was, again, Emily's interview with Tim Murray. They're obviously talking about the crash in November of whatever year that was.
2011,
So what's the verdict, Emily? Guilty, not guilty? Your sense?
I found him believable. I know. Jim's over there rolling his eyes.
But. Well, you know, when I'm watching I didn't see it when you did. I just saw it the next morning. Yeah. When I'm watching the thing, for example, when you started asking about the cell phone records, which admittedly I'm obsessed with from the night of the thing, he said, well, and I'm paraphrasing, well, you know, if I release him, no one's ever going to be happy. The media is going to be asking for a day, a week. And you said the appropriate thing, and I'm paraphrasing. No one's interested in who you called the day before or the week before. How about the cell phone
just
records on the day of the accident?
Well, but then he said that wouldn't satisfy a lot of people. He's probably right about that. Then we'd want more.
So then never disclose anything if that's the criterion, because there's always going to be a press that's going to say, I want more and
maybe
I want
more. Maybe he was meeting somebody he had set up, you know, a date with the night before. That's why.
Then he explains it. I mean, you know, we just spent the 10 minutes discussing the lack of transparency from the police, and I'm not equating Tim Murray's situation, obviously, with anything we were talking about.
Well, I asked him if he should. I said, why didn't you just do it? You could have cleared this whole thing by saying, I want those records released. And that was the response.
Well,
we heard what he was doing. He must have said this five times.
What's that?
He was doing the best he could. That was his line. He repeated that. I did the best I could, or I'm doing the best I can, or something like that. I said, okay, Tim, you're doing the best you can.
Well, I'm going to move on from this in a second. But let me just say this also. From your interview with him last night, and I'm paraphrasing. You'll correct me if I'm wrong, Emily, the other night when you interviewed him, is he said, you know, I've answered all these questions. I've done interviews. I've done this. To my knowledge, and correct me if I'm wrong, he's done an interview with you. I think he did an interview with Dan Ray on BZ Radio. We've asked this question repeatedly. The governor, who always defends him, when the governor says he's done all these interviews, I don't know. What interviews has he done except those two?
He did one with Joe Shortsleeve. He did have the press conference the first day.
Right, where Deval Patrick interrupted the questioners from the media and basically said, I'll answer the questions. He elbowed Tim Murray aside and said, this insinuation that you were all doing.
I think he was surprised that I was even still going over this material. When he came out of the studio, he was rolling his eyes and kind of shaking his head because I think, you know, I gave him he had 20 minutes. Okay. We covered a lot of material.
Now, he rolled his eyes. Who's going to roll our eyes now? You. Listen
hold
to
on,
this.
Hold on. Oh, go ahead.
Joe Tesh is this professor of psychology at Boston College. And Edgar B. Herwick III, our colleague, spoke to him. This guy's an expert in body language, his indicators of emotions and stress and cognitive behavioral methods to control stress. You want to know what he thought of Tim Murray? Sure you do. Fast blinking is an accurate indicator of someone being ill at ease. His blink rate was 77 per minute in the interview, well above what is the average on camera. Can I continue? Sure. Gaze aversion, which shows the inability to sustain eye contact with an interviewer, also an indicator of nervousness and insecurity. He averted his gaze 20 times a minute. That exceeded the previous record high of 18 shown by Roger Clemens during his congressional testimony on steroids in February of 2008. Finally, in conclusion, the body language of Lieutenant Governor Murray raises the distinct possibility he's not happy with the transition of leaving political office for a new job.
I have a wicked blink rate myself, and it's because I've got dry eyes. My contacts bug me,
you
so
are
who knows?
So
you know
charitable.
What, though? I'm not an expert like the gentleman that Jim just quoted, but is this a layperson? He does come across to me as a nice guy.
He's a nice guy.
He's got the boys regular.
He wasn't nervous at all. He was so relaxed. He went like this, if you don't know what that means, but kind of open-handed.
You like him. I mean, I think you can't help liking the guy. Yeah.
No, you know what open-handed means?
What does that mean?
You're really buying this, Emily? That's what. Okay. Every week, and this is really the only people listen to us on Friday, I'm assuming, is we get to this.
Incomprehensible.
It's out of control.
How about common sense? Doesn't matter.
Why not?
This is the kind of thing that drives people crazy. It's your right. Doesn't matter. I have absolutely no interest.
That, of course, is the intro to Emily's list. Okay,
that's
Emily.
Great.
What
right,
have you got
we
this week?
I already know the answer to this question.
Go ahead.
Does either of you have satellite radio?
Yes, no. I do.
You do?
I do. Yes, I do.
I do not.
Anybody in the control? No.
Nobody. I do.
And see Edgar's look? Of course not.
What do you mean, of course not?
Here's why. There's nothing on it. I bought a new car last year. I had it, you know, for a couple months. I let it lapse. And I'm driving home from, you know, upstate New York. And I thought, you know, I can actually see what's on. And I get on the phone and I re-up my subscription. It doesn't matter what you put it on, unless it's MLB or NFL radio.
May I respectfully disagree, since
there's
I'm the
nothing,
only one who owns it?
Nothing. Okay, CNN you can
wrong.
Listen to.
You ever hear
if
listen-
you do, like, top hits from the 90s. I'm going on here for a second. Top hits from the 90s. I didn't recognize a single tune. It's
okay.
All Jay-Z.
Is it my turn?
Yeah.
You know what Channel 31 is?
No.
Coffee House. You know what that is?
I know. I have Coffee House.
Fabulous. It's music. It's acoustic versions
boring.
Of rock and roll songs. How about if
awful.
You? How about if you want to listen
I have that one.
To CNN? If you want
CNN
to listen,
CNN is good. That's
okay,
the only
well, fine.
Thing.
Or MSNBC or Fox News.
Hundreds and hundreds of channels.
Bruce Springsteen.
There's no music.
You know what you're better off doing? I always do this when I'm traveling. I just go down to the bottom of the dial. NPR is usually around 8
I
or 9.
I do that, too. I
no
do
matter
that too.
Where you are, you just find the NPR station.
I'm shocked
to
you have satellite radio.
I'm shocked you
I'm
have
shocked.
Satellite radio.
Well,
it's
outrageous.
I had mine installed, by the way. I went out of my way to get it
mine
installed.
Mine came in my car. But...
And by the way, Marjorie wanted it installed. I told her where to go. She couldn't find the place. That's the only reason she
nothing
doesn't have
on.
It.
I've been looking for 6 months.
Nothing on it.
Okay,
there's no
fine,
reason to get
you.
It.
Next.
All right, next. Car insurance. Of course, I have an attitude about that, too. I don't think it should be mandatory, but that's a whole other thing.
Don't think it should be mandatory. Happens when some okay go. I'm sorry.
I don't think it should be mandatory, but do you all have AAA subscriptions?
Yes,
yes
I do.
Of course.
Why?
Because when you have an older car, don't wink at me. When you have an older car and your battery dies all the time for like $30 a year, they come and charge your battery in the dead of
winter.
Did
you also know,
or help you change a tire?
Did you know that your insurance policy
covers it?
Gives you a credit for being an AAA member.
I did not know that.
This is a scam. because it used to be that they gave you a 10% discount on your insurance policy if you were an AAA member. So basically, they're in bed with the AAA. Now, that discount has dropped to 2%. I have a new car. I don't need AAA because I'm going to call the Audi dealer.
But you
they're going to come.
A flat tire. What about a flat tire?
They do everything.
They do?
All the new cars, they do everything. But yet, I still have to get this AAA card if I want a measly 2% discount. It's a scam.
It's $30 a year or something.
I don't need it.
No, I think it's 50.
Whatever it is.
It's 52.
Okay.
It doesn't
52.
Matter. It doesn't matter. The point of the matter is that the insurance
company... Wait, I want you to know, Edgar just said in our ear, you get a 10% discount at Amtrak, which is a huge value if you're a AAA member.
Not anymore, I don't think.
Whatever. Okay.
I have been rescued by AAA so many times.
So
I've never called them.
Okay,
you have? Never in my life.
Emily is really angry today. What's item number three,
all right, this
Emily?
Is a good one. So this week in Pakistan, they killed. I know the Taliban number two person. Do you know how many times
we've killed the number two?
The number two Al Qaeda and the number two Taliban person. At least 40 times. We went back and did a little research. This is one of my favorite things because we've talked about
great.
It here before. But and how come nobody ever rises to
number one
again? Once you get Osama bin Laden, isn't there somebody else who
takes
over?
You know, by the way,
over?
I never thought of it until you just said it, but it is true.
Did you see that
We're
stack?
We're always crowing about the number two.
Tonya Megras printed out like a stack like this. Of
number twos?
Number twos. Like going back to like 2008. Number two Taliban, number two Al-Qaeda. In every country, you know?
You're right. Who is the number one Al-Qaeda now? Do I even know?
Whoever it is, they do never. They may. Sort of, you know, sort of like when Gabriel Gomez didn't make partner at Advent. It's a similar sort of thing. Is it? Maybe it's not.
Yeah,
okay.
Anyway,
let's move on.
All right.
Is
I only,
there more?
I only have one more.
Yeah,
those,
by the way, let me just
say
so far, they've been fabulous.
Good.
Fabulous.
Really
all right.
Good, yeah.
I've never been too hot a day in my life.
What?
I've never been too hot, so this weather is perfect for me.
Well, wait a second.
Love
Can
it.
I tell you something? And we're talking to Emily Rooney, obviously, on Open Mic. There are no bigger I hope you don't take offense, because I'm going to include myself. The two biggest complainers I've ever known are you and me. Is that a fair assumption?
Okay. I think you've taught me.
Oh, maybe I do. But I feel the same. If it were 95 degrees every day, I'd be the happiest man on the planet. I love every minute of it.
Me too.
I've often thought, and you're blue-eyed too, and sort of fair-skinned, that we sort of mistakenly, you know, should have been born in, I don't know, you know, the Dominican Republic or Puerto Rico or some Caribbean place, because that's where I feel like, oh, my God,
it's
this is
warm.
Great.
I love it.
I don't even have air conditioning.
I never complain about it. I never turn it on. I have it.
Yeah.
I never complain about the heat.
My children are
ever.
Whining about
so
it
So I'm not complaining.
Time.
You're not complaining.
No, I'm not complaining.
I have
I'm
to
ready.
Say, I would rate this week's four items on Emily's list as one of your best. It really, it was really right up there.
So satellite radio, insurance.
You hate the cold, I take it.
I don't hate it.
Yeah.
But, you know, it pains me much more than the heat.
I love the heat.
You know what the whole thing, if just to stay on this for a second, is everybody, even the people who wilt in the heat, first of all, you wear less clothing and you feel liberated.
Yeah.
And everybody looks, I mean, the reality is you look better when you're dressed that sort of way.
Jim's going to break out his Bermuda shorts.
Well, maybe I am.
Oh, God.
I used to have Madras shorts when I was a kid. I'm not going to break those out. But there's a whole, everybody relates to each other better. There's a whole, isn't there a much, why are you laughing at me?
It's much more social.
Exactly.
Yeah, downtown, everywhere you go. People aren't all bundled up with
their
heads down.
It's a lot of skin.
Yeah.
Hey, speaking of that in downtown, before you leave today, one of the things about hot weather, we brought, when Tom Menino has been on our show in the past, in the summers, we talk about how he should do what is done in a lot of American cities, including my hometown of Philadelphia, at least for a couple of streets, in July and August, shut down a couple of streets, maybe like Newbury Street, maybe Boylston. Let people drink on the streets at night. You know, you don't have to have your drink only in the bar that you're going to. Close off the streets. There's no vehicular traffic or that sort of thing. How great if you can walk down the street on an 80-degree night with a drink in your
hand. They do it once a summer. They have some car event that they do on Newbury Street. But I don't know if you're allowed to drink outdoors. I don't think so.
You know what the best thing I could possibly imagine? You're drinking on the street on Newbury Street on a hot summer night, and you have satellite radio in the background.
Oh, yeah,
would that be?
The coffee house.
In your Bermuda shorts.
Do you know what coffee house is, by the
I
way?
I haven't.
You would
love
not
car.
You,
no, it's
you.
Awful.
It's awful.
I have complimented you when you gave me a ride home because of my injured foot about your satellite radio coffee house.
So it's two against one on that one.
So out of 800 channels, one works out for you.
Maybe two.
Jim's a crooner. He likes to croon to those coffee house
songs. Emily, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much, Emily. What do you, what's the, well, whatever. You want to say anything? No, you don't. Okay, I knew you didn't. You're making an odd look at me. Emily Rooney, we'll see you next Friday.
Emily Rooney is on every night, Greater Boston, 7 o'clock, Beat the Press on Friday nights. Emily Rooney, thank you very much.
Coming up next on Boston Public Radio is the Friday News Quiz. Once again, that conversation with Emily was taped yesterday. A little bit of information came out on Tadashev and obviously the marathon bombing. Since coming up again, the news quiz right after this.
In the future, your wallpaper will become intelligent, and you'll talk to your wallpaper and say, I want to see RoboDoc. And boom, a animated doctor appears in your wallpaper that answers all medical questions with 99% accuracy.
Smart wallpaper, invisible cloaks, and teleportation are real projects underway right now. I'm Kara Miller. What else is in our future? Find out on Innovation Hub, Saturday morning at 10 here on WGBH Radio.
Funding for our programs comes from you and Suffolk University, committed to leading the conversation about technology and innovation in higher education. Host of Innovation Hub's College 2.0 event at Suffolk's Modern Theater, 7 p.m. on June 4th, moderntheater.com. And the Mark Twain Prize, honor the woman who has kept us laughing for years, Ellen DeGeneres, as she receives this year's Kennedy Center Mark Twain Prize for American Humor. Tune in Friday at 9 on WGBH2.
Some people say the 20s and 30s are the prime of your life, especially in Hollywood, but not Rita Wilson.
Being over 50 is completely liberating. I want to say to everybody out there who's listening who's not, get ready. It's a blast.
She tells us more about her new project, HuffPost 50. That's next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 2, here on 89.7 WGBH.
We love our contributors. That means you. And Providence Preservation Society, presenting Festival of Historic Houses, June 7th through 9th. You can tour interiors of 19th century homes, private gardens, historic mill buildings, artist studios, and more. Info at ppsri.org. And Ring Central, the business phone system in the cloud. Now with business SMS text messaging, voice conferencing for every employee, and Salesforce.com integration. More at ringcentral.com.
You're listening to Boston Public Radio, Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. It is Friday, so it must be the Friday News Quiz. This week in Studio 3, it is land versus sea. That's the theme today. We have Commander James Bernard Swampscott of the Boston Duck Tour. And I was very disillusioned to find out, Commander, that is not your real name. Your real name is Jim Healy?
That's correct.
That is really upsetting. I love Commander James Bernard Swampscott. I'd use that one if I were you.
Well, everyone calls me Swampy.
They do. That's very nice.
Is that because you have to have sort of these old Yankee names for the duck tour? Is that what that's
about?
Well,
every conductor has his own personality. And when I started in 1994, being very interested in colonial history myself, I took Commander James Bernard Swampscott after the city of Swampscott, Massachusetts.
Uh-huh.
You're looking at us like we didn't know there was a Swampscott in Massachusetts. Commander, we want you to know we did. By the way, the Duck Tour, is it still virtually every year voted the top small business in Massachusetts? It's unbelievable, isn't it?
I'm not sure what their definition of small is. We carry almost 600,000 people a year.
Really? Wow.
You have a great voice for duck tours, by the way.
Thank you.
You have a fabulous voice.
Do you know how many boats there are? How many duck tour boats there are? There must be dozens.
There are currently 28. We started with four in 1994. Now we're up to 28.
Wow.
Okay,
really fun.
And he is opposing Matthew Wilding. That's your real name, Matthew.
That's actually my real name.
I want to be clear. Thank you.
It's an awesome name.
Can we call you Commander Wilding?
You can call me Captain Wilding.
Thank you. Captain Wilding.
Now he outranks me. Yeah.
From the Freedom Trail Player, also known as the 18th Century Costume Tour Guide for the Freedom Trail Foundation. What do you dress up as? I love this.
So I played Ebenezer McIntosh, Captain General of the Liberty Tree, and thus the captain. The Captain General of the Liberty Tree, Ebenezer McIntosh, was the leader of the South End Gang. He was involved in quite a few riots, particularly the Stamp Act riot in 1766. And he also was very important in destroying Governor Thomas Hutchinson's house.
So, Matthew, where do you do this? Do you do this when people are going on the Freedom Trail at the beginning? Or
we do it all over.
All over.
We usually start at Boston Common.
Okay.
At the Visitor Information Center, every hour on the hour from 11 to 4. But we have a number of other tours from Faneuil Hall, and we can do pretty much anything people ask us.
Captain Wilding, if I can, McIntosh and Commander Swampscott, just for a second, I mean, in addition to your standard rap on what you think people want to know. You both have to be real students of history, because I assume there are tons of questions from the people on the duck boat or people walking with you. They just want to know additional stuff. So you do have to be a big-time historian, no?
Yeah, and I do have a background in history. I have my bachelor's degree is from Suffolk University in history, and I'm studying for a master's at UMass Boston right now.
Oh, you are. Congratulations on that.
Got a little bit going.
And so, Captain Wilding, if you go down to go on the Freedom Trail, how many people like you would a person see?
It depends on the day, but this time of year, so April, May, June, almost our entire group is out. So we have 39 active players.
Wow.
And about 10 rotators out in and out, and we deal with tens of thousands of students every
year.
Now,
Commander Swampscott, before we start, we're going to get to the quiz in a second. How long do you have to train? How much training is there? What are you, duck boat leader? What is that thing called?
Conductor.
Oh, conductor, of course. How long before you're actually allowed to drive one of those babies?
Well, when we hire someone, it generally takes a minimum of 6 weeks to train
someone.
Is that
really true?
6 weeks. That's a minimum, and it can run as long as 8.
It's fabulous.
And one other thing. When you do the duck boat parades, like when the Patriots win the Super Bowl or something, I mean, do people draw straws to get to drive the Tom Brady duck boat, or how does that work?
Oh, everyone wants to be a driver in one of those parades.
Yeah.
So we have we actually keep a list, and if you drove the most recent parade, you go to the bottom of the list.
Oh, that's fair and square. So yes. Have you ever driven any of the Patriots?
I've done 3 parades now.
Really?
What are they?
Which ones?
Yeah, I mean, Red Sox, Patriots, whatever.
I've done a Celtics, a
oh,
Patriots.
I forgot they won a championship.
And a Red Sox.
So
that is pretty
all.
Great.
Who's on your duck boat?
Actually, all the ones I drove were mostly friends and family of the players. I never actually drove one with the cheerleaders. That's the number one choice. Everyone wants to drive
good.
The cheerleaders around.
Yeah.
Or the players.
The players,
you know, Commander, you could have made up the answer to that. We would have never known. In any case, let's start with the quiz. Marjorie, why don't you ask the commander from Boston Duck Tour the first question?
Okay, you ready?
I'm ready.
Okay. Who's this man talking, and what honor did he receive yesterday?
King in Boston.
Can we play that again, if we can, one more time? We missed the first half of the soundbite. Here it is. Who is this guy, and what honor did he receive yesterday?
The car is no longer king in Boston.
Oh, but that would be our esteemed mayor.
That would be our esteemed mayor.
Mayor Menino,
and do you know
and
what?
He received an honorary degree from Harvard University.
Yes,
there
he
you
did,
go.
Commander.
Terrific.
Fine start. Now, did you know that, Captain McIntosh, or
did
you not?
But it's because it was in a promo from through the show earlier today.
Oh, so I love this guy. He listens. This is perfect. Now, here's your opportunity to tie this up. Ready?
Yeah.
Who is the speaker in this clip, and to whom is she speaking? Please listen.
And even though this is a college where Facebook was born, my hope is that you will try to go out and have more face-to-face conversations with people you may disagree with.
Now, let me give you a hint. That was not Tom Menino. Just to give you a hint.
It's so
who was
similar.
That, please?
I believe that was Oprah Winfrey talking to the probably unemployed Harvard University graduate.
That's right. That's very good.
You know what was
come try to get a job with you.
Hey, come on
don't
down.
You think?
I think we could take
every
your calls.
Absolutely.
You know what's beautiful?
What was beautiful?
I mean this sincerely. The photograph of Tom Menino
and Oprah
Winfrey sitting together.
Holding hands.
And all the regalia during the ceremony. It was quite great. So after round one, it is tied. Commander Swampscott from the Boston Duck Tour and Captain McIntosh from the Freedom Trail Foundation.
Okay, Commander, this one's a little bit harder. You ready?
Yes.
Can you name the politician speaking in this clip and what he is changing?
Going to do a party change, if that's what your choice is. Complete the box at the top, your name, address, date of birth, your party affiliation, your signature, and today.
Okay.
And you do have a pen.
So this is a party change. I'm a U.S. citizen and resident of Rhode Island, yes.
You know
do you
answer?
Happen to know who the male voice was?
I know the female was Abigail Adams. I don't know who the man was. I'm sorry.
So, Matthew, if you can do this, you win the points. Who is it?
This Lincoln Chafee.
Exactly. And what did he do yesterday? What did he change?
He changed his affiliation from, I believe, independent to Democrat.
That is exactly right. The governor of Rhode Island. He was a Republican before this whole deal.
A while ago, yeah.
And then an independent.
I believe Sheldon Whitehouse knocked him out a couple years ago.
I wonder if Kurt Schilling was there for the ceremony. Do you think he went for the...
I don't think so.
That's, I'm not
no,
going to explain
so.
It.
Okay. Go ahead, Jim.
You ready?
Yes.
Matthew, not you. You're not answering the question. Matthew is. I know you're ready. Okay, Matt, here's the deal. This news clip is a montage of people describing an ordeal. What is the ordeal?
We were like 20 feet from the fire. And the boats were lowering. That's when everyone started crying and, like, the lady passed out.
I just started crying. I thought, you're going to die.
Okay, so what is this again? This is, what is the ordeal that these people are describing? What is it, please, Matt?
I believe it was the disembarkment of the HMS Romney with Redcoat soldiers, wasn't it?
That would be.
You know, I don't know.
That may
no
be
idea.
True, but that is not the answer to this question.
This
now, you can steal this, Commander. What's the answer?
It was a cruise ship fire.
That is correct.
Very good.
On the stern.
Given the points, a Royal Caribbean cruise, 2,200 passengers had to be evacuated. The good news is no one died. The bad news is they all got a free cruise. Would you, after what has happened in the last few months, would you go on a cruise?
No. No.
Okay, fine. That's a direct answer. How about you?
I did quite a bit of cruising when I was in the Navy, and that was enough for me.
Yeah. On the deck boats, when you're out in the Charles, you can at least swim to shore if something goes
awry. That's very true. That's
you?
Very
yeah.
true.
That's my favorite part of the deck boats, when you go plunging. Where do you go plunging into the water? What do you call that?
It's North Point Park.
Okay.
Sort of
in
across
Cambridge?
From the Museum of Science.
Okay.
It's actually on the Cambridge side of the river.
Yeah.
Do you have one line as part of your duck tour thing that you consider to be your killer line that you use every time you take people that you can share with us or no, Commander?
Well, how much time do you have?
Well, it's not that much.
Well, I'll tell you just quickly. My character is an explorer, and I'm known for exploring the South Pacific. And 3 years ago, I was captured by headhunters on the island of Boro Pango. Mm-hmm. And before I could escape, they shrank my head.
Oh.
Now, as you can see, my head's returned to its normal size.
Yes.
Unfortunately, my brain is still the size of a golf ball.
Thank you.
That's why I may not do well on this quiz.
By the way, that's you had a big head before, and now you're just you're normal because of the
normal.
Shrinkage.
The first voice was that of Commander James Bernard Swampscott, otherwise known as Jim Healy, from the Boston Duck Tour. The second from the Freedom Trail Foundation, Matthew Wilding. Whose question is that? Who are we up now, too?
You can ask a question.
No, yeah. Which one are we? I think we're up to you asking the Commander
question. Oh, we are?
Questions.
Okay.
Go ahead.
You ready, Commander?
I'm ready.
Okay. What is this?
Knadel or knadel is a small mass of leavened dough cooked by boiling or steaming, as with soup, stew, or fruit, with which it is to be served. It's a dumpling.
As hold it back.
Max hoped to find at least one more knadel in his soup bowl, but all he discovered was his missing lower denture.
Okay.
That's
well, I know
one.
It's not a cooking show. Is it a spelling bee?
It is a spelling bee. It
very
is a
nicely
national
done.
Spelling bee. That's very good. Now, here's the, I think this is the bonus.
Bonus question.
The bonus question. You want to take a shot at spelling canadal?
You know, it was in the newspaper.
That isn't helping you right
I'm not
now,
a great,
Commander, yes.
I'm not a great speller.
Give
no,
it your best
on,
shot. You want it? No, nobody
all right,
passes
all right,
on it.
K-I-N-I-D-L-E.
You know
that's
what? You
very close.
You should have passed on it, Commander, if you know what I mean. No, okay, go ahead. Captain McIntosh, what's your deal? Can you spell canadal?
No, I can't.
Oh, come on. Give it a try. If he's playing.
I'm going to guess as a K and
yeah,
maybe an N.
Yeah.
So K-I-N-A-D-O-L.
No, it's close. You had a couple letters right.
Here we go. We get the actual answer from the actual Scripps National Spelling Bee.
Knadel. K-N-A-I-D-E-L. Knadel.
This is...
He's smarter than me. I mean,
the kid who won the whole shebang, so I guess he is pretty smart.
That's the 86 Scripps National Spelling Bee. It happened the last couple of days. That's pretty exciting, by the way.
Very
like
exciting,
that
Jim.
Do you ever see... What's the name of that great movie? Spellbound?
Spelling
you ever see
bee.
That? No, Spellbound, not Spelling Bee.
Canadal.
Okay, fine. Now, here's the next question. Matt, I believe this is your question. This is a famous actor describing how he got into acting. I want to know, who is he, and why was he in the news this particular week, please?
I was... dead broke, you know, and I was filling out job applications at various, well, anything, you know, video stores or coffee joints or whatever. And a friend of mine who happened to be an actor, he said, I think you should try acting. And I met his agent. She sent me to read for something and they hired me.
That's a pretty good voice, too, don't you think?
Yeah.
Do you know who it is?
It's a very handsome voice. That's Johnny Depp.
Very nicely done.
I believe is in the news right now because he's got that new movie Lone Ranger out, right?
Well, Marjorie, is that the answer?
I believe he does have the long
But that's not the
movie
answer to the question.
Well, that's not the answer to the question?
No, it isn't.
Johnny Depp is the answer
Yeah,
to
but
the question.
Why is he in the news is the question.
Oh, he's in the news. Oh, you want to try this, Commander? Do you know why Johnny Depp is in the news?
Well, I believe he was slated to play Whitey Bulger in an upcoming movie, and he turned that role down. There was a salary dispute.
Exactly. Black Mass, $20 million. He wasn't getting it.
That wasn't
and
enough.
So he just said no.
It says here the movie didn't do very well at the Cannes Film Festival.
No, it didn't do very well at Cannes, but it hasn't been released yet, whatever.
That's upsetting. Okay. I want it to be great.
The Lone Ranger?
No. Again, the movie had to be The Lone Ranger because he hasn't made the other thing. In any case, let's move on here if we can. What's the score, judges, if we can? A little confusion in the studio. By whom? Who's ahead here, please? Matt? Okay, I don't think that's true. In any case, I'm not going to read the score because we think we have the score wrong, but it's for the fun of the effort.
Oh,
is it
sure.
not, gentlemen? Okay.
There's actually a pretty brutal end game here.
What does that mean?
We can't talk about it on the air.
It's very frightening, actually. Freedom Trail versus Boston Doctor.
Hold on. Just skipped over this. Johnny Depp is not going to play Whitey Bulger.
No, he is not, and it's pretty sad, actually. And you know what's sad? That he's not doing it because of the dough. But there was a pay cut. Everybody's allegedly taking a pay cut, as the commander said.
Sequestration in Hollywood.
That's exactly.
Yeah.
Now, does Whitey get a cut of this? Or
I don't think he's going to be getting a cut of anything, actually. Next question for the commander from Marjorie Egan.
Okay, here we go, commander. We're going to play you a clip of Conan O'Brien from the White House Press Correspondents' Dinner and ask you why this joke is relevant this week.
Also, I'd like to acknowledge that earlier this evening, there was some confusion with the seating chart. For a moment, someone accidentally sat Governor Chris Christie with the Republicans. That was awkward, and I apologize.
Do you know why a joke about Chris Christie and Republicans is particularly relevant this week?
Well, I understand he's getting along very well with President Obama. Could it be that some Republicans think he's a turncoat?
We think that there's a bromance going on there between Chris Christie and President Obama, and that's exactly right. It rekindled this week. They rekindled their bromance on New Jersey's Point Pleasant Boardwalk. They went back there to commemorate the reopening of the Jersey Shore after the terrible Hurricane Sandy.
Now, we are moving to the lightning round, gentlemen.
Lightning round.
Now, this is one if by land, two if by sea. The premise is this. Since the Freedom Trail is all terrestrial, as you know, Matt, and the Duck Tour is water-based, we're asking Matt Wilding questions about ocean spray. We sort of turn the tables. And Commander James Bernard Swampscott, otherwise known as Jim Healy of the Boston Duck Tour, questions about Edwin Land. In other words, you get the land concept there?
Thank you.
The inventor of Polaroid film. Yes, we are. So for the Duck Tour, gentlemen, that would be the commander. Marjorie, the first question.
Okay. Edwin Land, in addition to inventing Polaroid film, what among these three inventions is he also behind? A, the Paranoid camera, using only a configuration of convex and concave lenses, this machine projected exterior shots onto any plane surface, creating a low-maintenance security camera for homeowners. That's number one, the Paranoid camera. B is the optics of the Lockheed U-2 spy plane. Or C, the tri-colored sequential screen, which converted black and white television sets. The screen was blue on top, clear in the middle, and green on the bottom to add blue sky and green grass to the black and white TV images. Do you get them all straight? Want me to repeat them?
No, don't repeat them.
I'll go with number two because I know he did some work kind of in that order during World War II.
You are correct. He invented the optics of the Lockheed U-2 spy plane.
Yeah,
very good,
these
Commander.
Questions.
By the way,
our brilliant producer in there, she writes them.
Those options were so long, I took a brief nap during the reading of option A. Now, this is for you, for the Freedom Trail fellow, otherwise known as Matthew Wilding, or Captain McIntosh. You ready?
Yeah.
With the urging of People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, otherwise known as PETA, Ocean Spray agreed to end its animal experiments. Ocean Spray had funded tests to do what? A, infect mice with some bacteria to cause stomach ulcers. The idea was to feed them cranberry juice to see if it helped treat the ulcers. B, to immobilize mice, confining them in small cages and overfeeding them so they would become obese. Then they treated the mice with high doses of cranberry extract to see if it had fat-burning properties. Or C, infecting mice's urinary tracts with microbes so they would get a urinary tract infection. Then they gave mice cranberry juice to see if it helped treat all of this. Which of those is Ocean Spray actually funded? What did they actually do?
All of those seem so feasible, don't
they? Yes, they do. What's the answer?
I'm going to try A.
That is exactly right. They gave mice ulcers, then tested to see if cranberry juice was a remedy.
You guys are really good. Most people get none of
nice
the answers
job,
right.
We're professionals, man.
You are professionals. Okay.
Wait, before we continue with the lightning round, you know, Freedom Trail is sort of older school in some ways. And, you know, the Duck Tour is, what is it, 50? How long has the Duck Tour been around?
1994.
Is that, I'm hoping that the answer to my question is people are still wild about the Freedom Trail. Are they?
Oh, yeah.
They are.
Yeah,
even though it's like, it's doing well?
It's doing very well. Our numbers have increased steadily over the past 10 years.
How long have you been there? How old would you say?
I've been there for 7 or 8 years.
And what'd you do before that?
I was in college.
Oh, you were? Well, that's a good
answer. I think that's a big thing. If you come to Boston, one of the things you do, right, is go on the Freedom Trail. And
the Freedom Trail is big, too.
Yes. Yeah, I know. I have a problem with a pronunciation problem. I have a speech handicap, but I do the best I can.
And you do wonderfully well, I should say.
Most of the time.
The next lightning round question is for the Commander James Bernard Swampscott from the Duck Tour.
This is another A, B, or C deal, multiple choice. Edwin Land.
You can go out and get a cup of coffee while she's reading the options, Commander, if you'd like.
And this is Edwin Land again. Once he conceived an idea, would take no breaks until the problem was solved. What extreme thing did he do during one of his brainstorms? A, he wore the same clothes for 18 days while solving problems with the commercial production of polarized film. That's A. B, he had doctors catheterize him so he would not need to take bathroom breaks while he was solving a problem on his Polaroid instant movie machine. Or C, he wore his horse's blinders so that not even his peripheral vision could distract him while he was working on the design of his large format Polaroid camera.
I would say A.
You are correct. He wore the same clothes for 18 days while solving problems with the commercial production of polarizing film. Wow, this is very impressive.
You know who I was with last night?
I didn't know any of these.
Harvey Silverglade was on my show, The Civil War. You know Harvey's wife is Elsa Dorfman,
yes.
Who's one of the few people who have those life-size Polaroid cameras. You ever seen that gentleman either, where they take the Polaroid pictures, come out as like life-size, literally? And you know there's virtually no Polaroid film anymore. And so this great art that Elsa and very few other people, she can, but for a limited period of time, because since Polaroid is out of business, nobody else is making the life. And if you've never seen it, just like a Polaroid from when we were young, where you pull out the picture, you used to pull it out and we'd get something, what was it, 3x4 or something like that when we were younger. She pulls it out and it's the size of a human body or 3 feet by 2. It's really an extraordinary thing out of this incredibly beautiful camera. There are very few of those in the world also. Okay, having said that. Matt Wilding from the Freedom Trail Foundation. Here is your lightning round question. Sylvia Scher was a food innovator who worked at Ocean Spray to create cranapple juice. What other successful food did she create? There are 3 quick answers. A, Clamato juice, if I pronounce that right. B, Miracle Whip, one of the worst things in American history. And C, Goober, that was editorial. Goober, that's the jar of alternating vertical stripes of peanut butter and grape jelly. Which of the 3 is Sylvia Scher responsible for, please?
It's the Goober stuff.
That would be wrong. You can steal the question, Commander, if you know.
Getting sick of that sound.
Well, I'm going to go 50-50 on this one. I'll just take a wild guess and say A.
That is correct. Clamato juice. Is that how you say it? Clamato juice? Is that
no idea.
Supposed to pronounce that? What is that? A little bit of clam and a little bit of tomato juice and that sort of thing?
Sounds delicious.
That is a horrible concept, is it not?
Good mixer.
Yeah, really.
Now, gentlemen, incredibly enough, we have time for an additional question or two. So here is a question that Marjorie, well, actually, I'll ask the question since I have the sheet in front of me. This is for you, Commander. This woman was on CBS Morning Show yesterday. She has strong local ties. In this clip, Gail King is asked about her husband. The question is, who is her husband?
I need to get up in the morning and have somewhere to go and something to do. What is he doing?
Well, he's been the most extraordinary husband this winter for me because I've been doing what I've been dying to do for a very long time, which is ride a lot. And I've been competing a lot and showing a lot. And he's been there supporting me and coming with me and watching me and helping me.
And, of course, who is the woman and who would be her husband, Commander Swampscott?
I'll have to concede I don't know.
You really don't know.
I have no idea.
Well, you have no idea.
I work in the morning.
I understand.
I watch television.
You don't need an excuse. It's fine. Captain McIntosh, you can steal this question.
I, too, have a job. I have no idea.
You have no idea? No. You want to give a little hint? Do you have any idea who it is, Marjorie?
Who Gail King is?
No, not who Gail King is. Who is she interviewing? And whose husband is the interviewee?
I guess Ann Romney.
That is exactly right. Give Marjorie Egan the points. Can she get a little bell? It's the first bell she's gotten. So who wins the quiz, by the way? Do we have any idea what the score was?
Okay.
Marjorie won the quiz. Gentlemen, I am so sorry. So we want to thank Commander James Bernard Swamscott from Boston Duck Tours. His real name is Jim Healy. How do you find Boston Duck Tours? Is there a website or something? Do you know it in your head?
www.bostonducktours.com.
That's pretty simple. It's a pleasure to meet you, Commander. Matthew Wilding, otherwise known as Captain McIntosh from the Freedom Trail Foundation. Do you have a website there?
It's thefreedomtrail.org.
Fair enough. You guys were great. Thanks so much for your time.
You were terrific.
Good luck with
the summer.
And thanks to all of you for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. On Monday, we have our political roundup. Jennifer Nassour, former chair of the Republican State Committee, Michael Goldman, big-time Democratic consultant. We're also going to find out, this is great, what improv can tell us about creating a saner, more friendly workplace. In between, you can find us on the web at wgbhnews.org/BPR. You can tweet us at BOS Public Radio. You can tweet me at Jim Browdy or Marjorie at Marjorie Egan. That's it for another great week. Have a wonderful weekend. I am Jim Browdy.
I am Marjorie Egan.
And we will see you at noon on Monday. See ya.